Good morning. I'd like to welcome everybody to the study session of the Mesa City Council for Thursday, April 23rd, is it?
All day.
April 23rd, 2009. We'll begin our meeting this morning with agenda item number one, which is to hear a presentation, discuss, and provide direction on the proposed funding recommendations for the fiscal year 2009-10 CDBG, home, and all those other acronyms, programs, and the Recovery Act of 2009 CDBG. That, by the way, I just used acronyms, Community Development Block Grant, right? And Homeless Prevention Funds and the 2009-2010 Human Services Fund. Mr. Villa.
Good morning, Mayor and Council. Ray Villa, Neighborhood Services Director. With me is Carolyn Olson, who is the Housing and Revitalization Director, and Lisa Wilson, who is a Human Services Coordinator. This morning, we're bringing forward the Housing and Urban Development's annual allocation and recommendations for the CDBG funds, home funds, and emergency shelter grant funds, ESG funds, along with the American Recovery and Reinvestment Act funds that were placed in this year's budget, 08-09, and finally with the human services funding towards the end. And I'm gonna go ahead and turn it over to Carolyn, who will do the presentation.
Good morning, Mayor and Council. We'll start with slide number four. Those are the amounts shown on slide number four, the allocations for the various programs. CDBG, the $3,383,197, and we are just estimating that because we have not received as of yet our official allocation, so we're basing it upon last year's funding. The CDBGR, or that stimulus funding, is $918,921. The homeless prevention stimulus money is $1,405,94. Home, $1,251,948. And that is also based upon last year's funding because we have not received this year's allocation yet. We are not receiving ADDIE funds this year. They did away with that fund. That is the American Dream Down Payment Initiative. They did away with that funding stream this year. ESG, Emergency Shelter Operating Grant, in the amount of $151,133, and that has been confirmed that that is the amount we will receive. On the next slide, we have listed the eligible activities, some of the eligible activities for the CDBG Community Development Block Grant program. So these would be eligible activities that we could fund. The next slide talks about our home program. And this program is basically to create affordable housing for low-income households. This funding does require a 25% match, and it requires us to take 15% off the top for allocation to our community housing development organizations, or CHODOs. And beginning this July 1st, we will be administering those as a city, as a participating jurisdiction.
Councilmember Richens has
Can you explain what that means and what that change is? Because before, weren't we participating in a consortium?
Right.
And so we're pulling out of that consortium. Could you
Correct.
Tell us the ramifications of that?
Last year we informed the consortium that we were pulling out of it. And the reason why we pulled out of the consortium is a consortium is usually developed in order to pool funds together, especially with organizations or cities that don't have the amount of funding they need to complete certain projects within their jurisdiction. We've been a city that has been able to develop. We've had our money has grown over the years, and we felt that by pulling out of the consortium, that we could most effectively use our funding here in the city, also reduce the amount of administrative funding that we have to fund through the county and take that back to the city so we can use it to reallocate out to the community. So we felt that this would be an overall benefit from us from pulling out of the consortium because we are a direct funding agency anyway. We get that through CDBG funds, and we felt that the home funds would, we could also manage those properly and be able to get them out to the community a little quicker, a little easier.
Ray, can you just explain, what was the amount that we were sending for the administrative? What was that amount?
It was about $65,000 a year.
$65,000. So essentially, for a city our size, it's very unusually part of these groups, the smaller groups, the pools or resources together. We've been able to take that $65,000 and put it more into the program itself as opposed to paying somebody else for the administrative side of it. So we just thought it was a better way to get dollars actually into the program, delivering the projects, as opposed to paying someone else for more additional administrative costs.
It was an important change that we made, and I just want to make sure we all understood that that was a shift from what we've been doing in the past. Thanks.
On to slide number 7, our ESG funds. These funds, they are for operations and rehabilitations of the emergency shelter facilities within our community. And the Human Service Advisory Board does review and make recommendations on that, on those funds. The next slide, actually 8, 9, and 10, involve recommendations for the current CDBG funds. Slide number 8 is looking at nonprofit groups that applied and are recommended. And slide number 9 looks at city departments that applied and are recommended. And slide number 10 looks at a summary of those two slides. Okay, slide number 11 talks about our home funds.
Councilmember Richards has
I can have a lot of questions, but just settle in. You point out later about the $242,000 in unallocated funds. Is that the same as the like the reserve that you usually keep, or?
No, that would be part of this year's $3 million allocation. That is yet unrecommended.
Okay, because you usually you have a pot of money that is, what is it called, contingency?
Non-specific project
funds.
Well,
typically, though, in this area, though, we try to allocate all of it. What will happen, though, at the end of the year, there'll be balances from agencies for projects that they weren't able spend the money or the project gets canceled. So there are, I don't want to call it the same thing like we talk about in the other funds. It's
non-specific project funds.
Okay. So it is, but it is different than the contingency funds that we usually
We don't really set up contingency funding in CDBG because we are under such strict mandates to spend all the money. So we really try to allocate all of it as much as possible. Inevitably, you know, some projects don't come about. So then we reprogram it again. And that's why you'll see some of the dollars in here are actually, we're programming dollars that may have not been spent in past years.
I'm just trying to figure out if it's a pot of money, a separate pot of money, or if it's just something that we're calling different this year. It sounds like it's just something we're calling different.
And we'll go, when we go through the, I think if we can, once we get through the entire program projects, what we're trying to do is look at everything in a big picture so that if there's dollars that are available that we could, reprogram where we've identified, like as you just mentioned, the difficulty in this process is you have to go through a very formal kind of notification and application process in order to allocate those dollars.
Great.
So basically, these charts are based upon our estimated allocation for the year of the 3 million. So that's what we're actually looking at these charts. Slide 11 talks about our home funds of the applicants and also the recommended projects. And slide 12 is a summary of the home funds and also the ESG applicants and the recommendations for those. On slide 13, we just are kind of talking about the comment period here. The public comment began on April 5th and ends on May 6th. There will be a public hearing held at the council session on May 4th, and that is basically just another way for people to present comments. They can submit those written. This is a chance for them to submit them orally. And any comments we receive, of course, would be forwarded to council members, and they will be submitted to HUD. On slide 14, on council actions, the public hearing, as we said, will go forward on May 4th. However, there's been a change in the approvals. Those will happen at the special council meeting on May 7th, the approval of the plans and the projects. And slide 15, that's basically reiterating the previous slide, and those will be the individual approvals that will need to be taken. Slide 16 indicates where anyone would be able to submit comments to myself. And that would be available for anyone to do.
Councilmember Richens.
The plans that we're approving are just the annual plans, and right. we have a five-year plan that's due here shortly. This is not any part related to the five-year plan.
Right. Well, actually, we have a one-year action plan that we'll be approving, and because we are no longer in the consortium, we were told to do a one-year consolidated plan to get us out of the five-year we were in with the consortium. So we'll be doing a one-year consolidated plan and also an annual plan. And next year, we will do a five-year consolidated as just the city of Mesa. And also, we'll do an annual plan next year, too.
Great. Okay. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Moving on to slide 17, we're now going to talk about the Recovery Act money, the stimulus monies. And the CDBG, we refer to that as CDBGR, so if I say that, that's the recovery monies and homeless prevention and rapid rehousing. Slide 18, City of Mesa was allocated $918,932 for a CDBGR, and even though it says allocated, we do have to submit an application and amend our 0809 plan in order to receive those funds. And this funding is to create suitable living environments for low-mod folks. And this project must be ready to go within 120 days of grant receiving those funds. And we're anticipating that to be around September when we will receive those funds.
Mm-hmm. Carolyn, I just wondered on from page 4, you know, where your original slide that showed the CDBGR. Mm-hmm. And it had nothing allocated for 09, 010 with a little asterisk. Is this because this is where the money is coming from?
Right. This is actually, to be technical, this is current year money because the money came out in 08, 09. It's actually 08, 09 money for use in 910.
Okay.
So that's just kind of a technicality for us to have to amend our 09 plan or our 08 plan.
Okay. Great, thanks.
That, and it's one time shot.
That's what we didn't spend that last year in.
No.
Got it.
Correct. It's a one-time deal. Slide 19. Because after taking a look at this project, we looked at the applicants that currently applied this year to our funding cycle, and a new leaf had applied to build make some renovations to the East Valley Men's Center. What they want to do is build a freestanding kitchen and dining facility and a freestanding basic needs building and expand the shower and restroom facility there at the shelter. And because they were a current applicant, we felt that was a good fit for this project. And so that's why we are recommending to you that we use that money for a New Leafs project. Slide 20. Our homeless prevention and rapid rehousing money, Mesa was allocated $1,405,94. And this also, even though it says allocated, we do have to do an amendment and application, and we will be submitting that. And some of the eligible activities are listed there on the slide, the rental assistance, deposits, and so forth, as you can see on that slide. On the next slide, this program is basically targeted to those households who have become homeless, or it is inevitable that they will become homeless. And this program has many federal requirements. Persons must be at 50% AMI, which for a family of four, that's $32,950 per annually. And some of the program requirements to that are intensive case management for the families, rent reasonableness requirements. That means before we go ahead and pay any rent, we have to do rent reasonable. We have to make comparables in the neighborhood that the rent is reasonable. And they base that on the housing choice voucher model. Inspections must be performed on every unit before it can be funded. And this has to be done by a housing quality standards inspector. And income verification must be done. And they have based the income verification model on the housing choice voucher program. That means there's a process that's already in place that already do that. And also properties assisted may not be owned by the grantee, any subgrantee, a subsidiary, or any affiliation with any subgrantee. So basically what this program is to help those who have become homeless who may not have ever had to use systems before. that they could possibly have lost their job and they're behind in their rent. They can't pay their utilities. They need to move because they're being evicted. So this is to help those folks who have fallen through the cracks that, that probably don't even know where systems exist. And so that's what this program is focusing on. The next slide, we looked at organizations.
Councilman Kavanaugh has a question.
Yes.
Thank you, Carolyn. It's relation to this particular slide. With regard to the housing and revitalization, or actually I'm on slide 22, I guess. With regard to the housing revitalization, is it your intent that, that city staff would actually be doing case management with the utility rental assistance, or are you doing that through contracted services?
We have spoken with a New Leaf, and they would be doing some for utility and also Save the Family. They have shown an interest, and they have specified that particular amount that they would like to do.
Right, and I see the $100,000 for New Leaf and $70,000 for Save the Family, and the 1.235, and that's being used by your staff. Is your staff going to be doing any of the utility and rental assistance, or are you focusing on the other part of it?
Yes, because the program so closely mirrors the Housing Choice Voucher Program, and the processes are already in place for verifications, for rent reasonable, for inspections and so forth, and the housing office usually gets many, many calls of people when they find out they can't pay their rent, they're going to be homeless, they go to their website, they go to their city, and they say, how can you help me? And they come to the housing, and they call us. And so we receive many of those calls constantly. We always have, and we've received even an increase in the past few months of people. So we're kind of the first call for housing, so we would be able to help those folks in a very timely manner.
Right, and you're confident you have the capacity, staff capacity to handle this?
Yes, we do.
Thank you. Thank
I'm
you,
still a little confused. Is the difference between your utility assistance and a New Leaf utility assistance?
It's just they would do the majority of it. It's just that if somebody came to us, we don't want to have to say, well, you need, you know, we'd look at their situation and say, well, you need rental assistance. We can help you with that. But you need, and you also need utility assistance.
Okay.
But now you'll have to go over there.
So what you're saying is in New Leaf, if someone came just for utility assistance, they'd probably end up at a New Leaf. If someone came in and had a myriad of issues, and part of it, part of the package that they had was utility assistance. It's just, it's an add-on. And rather than separate or bifurcate those services,
correct,
you just take care of it all.
Correct. We don't want to give people the run around, like you can come here for this and there for that. It just gives us an opportunity.
Wait a second. You're government. You're supposed to give people the run around.
Our customer service doesn't work like
good.
That.
Good. Good answer. Councilmember Richens, I know.
Of the allocated amounts, is that the actual money to be used to help pay utility bills, or is that a portion of that for administration? How does that pot of money work?
They would be entitled to 5% for administrative fee. That's all that is allowed in that program.
For all three organizations, us, Save the Family, and New Leaf.
Right. Correct.
Thank you.
Okay. Moving on to slide 23, because that homeless program, you know, we want to get that out to folks a lot because, like I said before, these aren't people that know the systems in any way. We've looked at an extensive marketing program, and some of the things we've come up with is that we will outreach at neighborhood meetings. We'll create flyers and get that out. We'll collaborate with the Mesa Business Services Department if utilities are being disconnected and so forth. We'll do outreach to Channel 11, and we'll meet with other community organizations. And we'll just try to, when the money, they're saying the money will probably come around September 30th, and at that time we'll really start marketing the program and before that.
Are those marketing expenses a separate line item, or are those included in your 5%?
They would be included if there was any cost to them. I mean, we'd have to
as
those.
Part of the 5%
yes.
limit, or as a separate line item over and above the 5%?
It would be within the 5%
okay.
if we had to expend any funds.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. On to slide 24. For the homeless prevention money, that substantial amendment is due to HUD on May 18th, and HUD will take a look at that. They're anticipating that September 1st, they would execute the agreements, and the money would be available around September 30th. So it's not real close, but it's a little bit out there. Okay, at this time, I'll turn it over to Lisa Wilson, and she's going to speak to the Human Services Program.
Good morning, Mayor and Council. The Human Services Advisory Board does a very extensive process when they review applications. They do it simultaneously with the CDBG allocation process. First, we do an online training information meeting. The board goes on site visits, and then staff makes their recommendations. The board makes their recommendations, and then we forward those recommendations to the City Council. Last year, we allocated $839,278 in funding. This year, the funds allocated will be decreased by 30%. General funds, $511,895. And then the ABC funding has been reduced because of the decrease in donations. Next slide here. The board based their decisions using the community safety support model. And the community safety support model engages programs that directly impact city safety services. We also support programs and services that encourage independence and self-sufficiency for our residents. We also ensure that we don't duplicate any services. Next slide. We seek to fund programs that have been proven successful and have diverse financial streams. We also fund programs that educate and folks on how to prevent long-term dependence on services. Next slide there. We have five funding areas that we use. Prevention early intervention, and that primarily helps at-risk youth. The transitional services removes barriers to allow for self-sufficiency. Crisis services, that's our priority. We fund basic needs using that area. The long-term system support maintains independence. And then the system support helps make social service delivery system easier for the community to access. Currently, programs that we're funding is the Central Arizona Shelter Services. It's the only facility that provides emergency shelter for women. We have the Child Crisis Center, which is also another emergency shelter. Community Bridges, they provide detoxification services and substance abuse prevention. A New Leaf, we have four programs under New Leaf that we fund. The Client Services, which helps with rent and utility assistance. The East Valley Men's Center, and that's the emergency shelter and also transitional working men's shelter. Autumn House Domestic Violence Shelter. Then we have La Mesita, which is the family shelter here in Mesa. We also fund the East Valley Senior Services Home Delivered Meals Program. Then the Mesa Boys and Girls Club Teen Center, which teaches anti-gang prevention and coping skills to youth. The Mesa YMCA provides us the First Offenders Program, which provides counseling for youth that are at risk. The Mark Center, they provide job training for the developmentally challenged in Mesa. Save the Family provides case management and transitional services for families that are experiencing homelessness. Then we have the United Food Bank, and they provide emergency food boxes for Mesa residents. And as I said before, our crisis services is our priority area. And the numbers that you see here are the requests, staff recommendations, and the board recommendations. And you'll also notice the 30% decrease in the funding there. On this slide, the board and staff recommendations differ with the Central Arizona Shelter Services. Next slide. And in the prevention area, you can see the teen center has different recommendations for staff as well as board. The board recommended zero, staff recommended $11,590. In the transitional services area, the board and staff recommendations remain the same. long-term system support area. We have the East Valley Senior Services Retired Seniors Volunteers Program, and the board and staff recommendations differ there, as well as in the Caring Corps program, which provides volunteers go out and provide companionship and help seniors. The East Valley Home Delivered Meals, there was also a difference there from the staff and board recommendations. And although, well, yes, next slide, yeah. No, that's good, no, that is. we couldn't recommend all of the,
I just had a question. Looking at the requests, the staff recommendations were just the 30%. Did the board actually realize that they cut 30% too, and they just allocated it differently, or did they not cut the 30%?
During our first blemish, they did not know. They knew it was a possibility that we would have the cuts. So when we made our first blemish, it was with the level funding. And so we had to come back and review it again. And this is where you see how we kind of allocated to make everybody.
So that's how the staff number is, but the advisory board just was based on the initial understanding that they weren't cutting.
No, they were based upon the 30%. They came back and looked at it again, and we instructed them to relook at their allocations based upon a 30% funding decrease. So those were with that in mind.
So the column of the, if I added the staff column in the advisory board column, they're the same totals? They just,
yes.
Okay.
Yeah, they're
same
totals.
They just had different choices.
Okay, thank you.
Exactly. Yeah.
There were some programs that we could not recommend funding due to the lack of funding, and they were ANA Cottages, which provides transitional housing for young women leaving the foster care services, Advocates for the Disabled, which helps folks file for their disability insurance, Care Partnership Wellness Program, which is a pediatric clinic for in Mesa, Community Information and Referral, which is the 24-hour information hotline, Mercy Housing's financial management classes, the House of El Elyon, expecting teens housing, and then Sarine Adult Daycare, which provides daycare services and assistance to Alzheimer's, folks experiencing Alzheimer's.
Now that we've come to the end of our presentation, on the last slide, you'll notice we have a couple options for you to consider. Because we have that $242,699 that is unallocated in our CDBG funds, we would like to offer you two alternatives. One being you can choose to reallocate that funding to applicants who have currently applied. That would be the ones that currently are listed on our CDBG funds sheets, those back on those slides. That would be one option. The second option would be to open an additional process to choose additional subrecipients for that CDBG, those CDBG funds. Staff would offer technical assistance to any organization that would like to apply, and we could talk to them about what eligible activities would fit in with the programs that they're currently funding, that they're currently providing.
Councilman Kavanaugh has a question.
Thank you, Mayor. It's more, I guess, more a comment. I really appreciate the presentation. This is very thorough and one of the best ones that I've seen in through the years in terms of understandability. So I really appreciate that. With regard to just my reaction to the alternatives on the CDBG side, I would hope that we would look at option number two, that we could permit any of the eligible organizations, whether it's the nonprofit or city departments, to make another run and provide us with some other options to look at. That would just be my preference. On the human services funding as well, your cover memo, or the more detailed memo, not the slides, also provided alternatives for the council to consider in terms of funding. And I've made no secret of the fact that I disagree with the 30% reduction in human services funding. I would hope that we would look at least level funding from what we did last year, if not being able to increase it. And the reason I'm saying this, Council, is in the context of the last number of years, we've been steadily decreasing the human services funding, and over at a time, even during good times, the needs in our community were increasing, and then the events of the past 8 or 9 months, I think, have accelerated that process. And I think this is one of those areas where we have to make some investments there. We chose as a city to have a community investment model where we partner with the private sector in terms of delivery of most services. And I think we need to be a good partner to our agencies, because if we keep on the trend of reductions, I think for some of the organizations, the reduced city funding might be the tipping point to actually tip those organizations over, because our money serves a great leverage purpose in terms of other private funds, other grant funds that people can receive. And so I think as we look at our budget process, this should be a priority for us to look at. But I really appreciate the work that's been done. I think the Human Services Advisory Board did a very fine job in evaluating and making difficult choices, and as well as on top of the work that staff's work is incredibly difficult given the needs of the community. And you're very caring and considerate, I think, for the community, and work well with the organizations, and I appreciate that. Thank you.
Councilmember Higgins.
Thank you, Mayor. This is kind of confusing. I'm just going to say it right up there. The funding alternative page, can you explain that again? Why is there the $242,699 that's available and the different options? Could you just kind of run through that and why that's there and the pros and cons of each of the alternatives, because from your point of view?
Yes, the reason why we have the difference in the funding is when we went back and looked through our funding for this year, we found out that part of our housing rehab program that we run right now, a majority of the work, or a large portion of the work that they're going to be doing this next year, is going to be handled through the NSP program. And so because of that, the administrative costs, or some of the costs to do that program, will be handled by that program, alleviating about $200,000 from there to actually probably a little more, about $280,000 from that, to alleviate some of the spending in that area. So because of that reason, we felt that we had some additional pot of money, that they had enough work to do based on that additional funding through NSP, that we would be able to then free up some CDBG funding to go ahead and to either put it into these two areas, to reallocate it out to the existing agencies that are already applying, or to open up a new process to allow other agencies to apply. The other situation we wanted to do is we want to see if there's an opportunity here based on that funding for agencies to be able to apply for the funding and maybe be able to make up some of the human services fundings that are lost this year, if there may be a way to do that. And that's the reason why we're pushing it this way.
So the CDBG money can also be used anywhere where it says human services. See, that's where I get confused.
No, not really. You'll see on there that we have broken out. There's a certain cap on public service that we can only pay out of our entire amount of CDBG.
Okay.
So if you look on your spreadsheet, it does talk about, over in the first column, it says what the activity is, and where it says public service, those things have already been recommended for public service.
Okay.
So we only have the $92,421 available for public service use. So okay. Human services, they can apply for any funding, the entire amount. However, that would be funding that would be eligible for those types of services.
So, Mayor and Council, one of the things we're discussing, I mean, first of all, when we made this whole process, CDBG requires an application, whether it's a city-funded project or program or a nonprofit, and that begins very early on, way before the NSP program. We knew where that was. So we applied, as we would typically every year, for the full amount for our own internal housing rehab program. Obviously, with an NSP program, we're going to be able to shift most of our resources. All those costs are going to be able to be covered on that side. That's where the savings is coming from. And so we've identified that and said, okay, listen, we don't need those CDBG funds. We make those available for additional, either one, to take existing programs that are applicants, take the current applicant pool and allow them, that the council could allocate out the entire amount to the existing applicant pool. But recognizing that some of the challenges we've had and the reductions that we're taking in the human services group, and this is another process. Even though we're bringing them to you all together because we want you to get the big picture, it's a separate process managed by the staff on the general fund because those are general fund dollars. And not necessarily are the same applicants in the CDBG program. So what one proposal would be, if council's interested in allowing these human services groups to apply for CDBG funds, we can't just go allocate it today. We would actually have to go reopen up the process for this limited amount of dollars. One of the things we propose is we've got a cap. It's the only category, correct, Carolyn, in the whole CDBG? It caps out at 15% of the total allocation in public service. And so our cap amount, to get to the cap, we have about $96,000 left before we get to that cap on the CDBG allocation. One of the thoughts we had, though, too, is we could go to these groups in human services, and while we may be capped at $96,000, we can also talk to them about other opportunities, maybe other projects or programs they have going on other than what they provide to the city that they may be able to tap into the CDBG process. So that is the proposal, is a recommendation, is allow us to move forward with what we have, except for the $242,000, and then reopen it. Maybe seek direction from the council if you would like us to focus on trying to establish or prioritize programs that meet a lot of the same criteria that we are funding under human services, those life safety programs, then we would reopen it, work with the nonprofits that maybe haven't applied before in CDBG, help them in their application process, and then bring those back to the city council for consideration.
Okay, can I continue that a question though on that same topic? Just because it doesn't. So we have like page 8 and 9, the spreadsheets that show the CDBG monies from nonprofits. Some of those same nonprofits have funding through the other programs and what do you call that? The service, what did we call those? I'm sorry.
Human service.
Yeah, human service area. Two different pots of money, right? Now, is it where we had to cut some of the human service monies from these groups at by 30%? Could those people is there a way that they could get some of their funding back through the CDBG money that's left over?
Yes, they could apply for that. That's where that 92,000 would actually be eligible for those particular services that are in the human services.
But not the additional 200-ish.
Unless they had other programs within their agencies that they would apply for some of the other. The others are housing projects and economic development. Those are the other two categories that can be applied for in CDBG.
Okay, so it's very specific. It's okay.
Councilman Richens has
it. Thank you.
If we're spending, I get the cost savings there about the NSP program. Why are we spending any money on housing rehab? If we're spending $10 million on housing rehab through the NSP program, we still have $730,000, which is probably the largest allocation within CDBG, with an additional $200,000 to administer that program. How much administration is there already in NSP? And then there's still $200,000 in this allocation for housing rehab administration, and then an additional $730,000 in projects in this CDBG allocation. I mean, Why do we have any money in there?
Because we have a lot of Mesa residents that 730 will cover a lot of emergency projects. A lot of our Mesa residents depend on that program. If air conditioners go out, roofs, you know, a lot of those programs, the emergency programs. So we still, you know, could keep that program going to some extent because the Mesa residents do. We have a long list of people who want to take part in that program now.
So as I'm trying to follow this. So what you're saying is that's a different program. That housing rehab is different than the $10 million is what you're saying.
Yeah.
That $730,000 primarily takes care of small emergency one house, two house type of thing, whereas the $10 million is a planned, targeted
foreclosure.
Focused foreclosure and other things. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah.
Okay.
That's not how you have it listed on your project delivery. You have listed, you know, so many houses rehabbed on that, like 30 full rehabs, or what was the number on that? And a certain number of small rehabs. Is it full rehabs or is it small rehabs?
Yeah, we would have to make that change in there, because even though we would do that, the money, the pot of money would come out of NSP, because we did 26 rehabs last year, and we spent, I think, about $1.4 million to do the 26 total rehabs, plus the emergency, you know, like the air conditioning and the housing and so forth. So we would
have to... What is that per unit? Somebody do the math for me real
quick. Usually, we average around 20...
Can we have a calculator? 1.4 million, 26 rehabs. Where's our budget director guy? He's got a calculator ready.
Chris has it.
I can answer that question. Usually for the major rehabs, they average about $40,000, but that's a total overhaul of the whole house. On the emergencies, we're averaging about $3,600 per emergency project.
Is that what you got, Chuck?
Well, just a flat average is $53,800.
That's for the overall average, when you put the pot together. But when you break it out, that's what it basically comes down to.
Okay.
Okay. Councilmember Summers?
Thank you, Mayor. On the funding alternatives, or back to that, I would prefer to have the greatest level of flexibility, so I'm more inclined to open up the process. On that, maybe Mr. Brady, what is the timetable for that process? Are we looking at shortening that, doing an abridged version, or how long does it take to get through that? Because I imagine that there are timetables that have to be met.
No, there's requirements for notices.
Actually, if we were to open another round, it would probably take 90 days to complete by the time we create an RFP and put a notice out to all the organizations to make sure they have a notice and have ample time to put their application together. We have to do 30-day comment periods. We have to amend our plan.
So 90 days actually gets to the start of the fiscal year, though.
We're at the fiscal year.
We're talking about a good 90 days.
Okay.
Because I think, and the reason I would lean for two is I think they're, in looking at the list of folks who applied and those who did not, I think there are a number of services that did not apply that should have the opportunity to do that, both in our own cities and in our own city and some other organizations as well. One area that doesn't seem to be well represented is job retention and creation, and the opportunities, particularly in the downtown area along the Fiesta District and West Mesa, is to create some opportunities for. I mean, we can house somebody for the short term, but the real solution is to provide some jobs to help attract and retain the businesses that are going to employ these people gainfully. So that should be a focus of the CDBG as well. So I think option two would allow us to pursue some of those opportunities. Thank you, Mayor.
Thank you. Councilman Fenter.
Thank you, Mayor. A couple quick questions. I presume this 242 is one-time funds for this year? Thinking outside the box a little bit, is there any opportunity for code enforcement along these lines? I know that's getting away from housing or human services. CDBG areas that target, as far as code enforcement, anything along those lines as a possibility?
They would be able to apply like everyone else.
Yes.
Okay, it is on the list. Okay.
Well, yeah, and let's be real clear here,
yeah,
Aaron Council, because I know sometimes we kind of talk in these generalities. We are getting up against some deadlines. So if the council, what I really need today is council direction. If the direction from the council is that you want us to pursue opening this back up, we will. But I can just kind of going around the table here, I can assure you that we're well above the $242,000 that's being available. So frankly, it helps us when we're going out for this process and soliciting applications. It's good to give direction or at least some sense to the community what is the priority of council. If it's human services, that's very helpful because we can go back to the groups that we currently fund of the general fund, talk to them about the opportunities in CDBG, work with them on making an application. We typically focus in that process, our priority has been, that's why Lisa spent time kind of walking through, are kind of those life safety, public safety related emergency agencies to assist us in providing that relief.
Our intent today, if we were to move forward, at least our expectation is, we would go through a process opening up the CDBG process, but with a focus on encouraging and working with those types of individuals or nonprofits to apply. If we're interested in adding additional code compliance officers, that's a possibility. We do fund how many today? Six?
Five,
and there's six in here, so there's an additional code officer in here.
But Chris, they can only work on CDBG-eligible census
correct.
Tracts if
correct.
They're funded with CDBG.
Correct.
So there's only certain parts of the city that they
correct.
Can work.
That's correct.
How many can you pack into our CDBG-eligible census tracts?
Is that a riddle?
Yes, actually.
Well, and then the other thing is, even economic development, we can do economic development related projects or personnel, but that obviously would come out of these same dollars here, and they would be they would have to do their work, and their performance would be related to the, again, limited to the CDBG.
Well, Mr. Brady, I understand what you're saying. There's two things, though. On the other hand, I want to put this in context, and I think one of the problems we have in this process is we're looking at $242,000. And we're trying to micromanage that in the context of a $1 billion budget. And I think that that when you get down to human services, we have a different approach in Mesa than other cities have. And to go back to what you said, that we concentrate on certain areas. And while that may seem like a small percent, it is a small percentage of a $1 billion budget, at the fringes, it's significant to each of our agencies. And I think that as we look at this, we need to take into context as the overall budget, and as we come up with revised and tweaked revenue projections and cost projections, I would think that we need to maybe put all that into a pot and see how it falls out, and this $242,000 would be sort of part of that, is what I'm seeing, rather than try to micromanage the $242,000 right now, because I don't know where we may have a slight change in our revenue projection, upward or downward. That's going to affect our overall budget and how the overall human services may be affected. You know, in 2 weeks from now, we may be talking about a different pool of money than we are today. So I tend to agree with Councilmembers Kavanaugh and Summers is to provide a little bit of flexibility. And then 90 days to me is not a killer because we're right into the middle, right in the start of the fiscal year. Okay, let's start with Councilmember Richens and then Councilmember Higgins.
I guess this is one of the problems that I don't know how much minutiae we want to get into here, if we want to start talking about individual projects or if that's even appropriate, but
no. Okay. To answer your question, we got a long agenda, and I think there's ample time for individual.
This is important. The dollars that go out to help
it
rehabilitate and revitalize our community, and so this is some discretionary money that is really important, can do a lot to revitalize and stabilize neighborhoods if we spend it right. And as I look through, this is about what, a $4.5 million pot of money? As I go through and I add up all the admin, I get to over $1 million in administration. So we're spending $1 million to push $3 million out on the street. That is government inefficiency at its finest. And that's not even including NSP dollars. I mean, I have your home allocation, $187,000. Your rapid rehousing now that has $61,000 in it. CDBG administration, $400,000. Rehab project delivery, $200,000 to do $730,000 in rehab. There's a private sector homeowner company doing that. They'd be out of business. The $100,000 in there for legal services. And again, not even including the, how much of it is it, 10%? To do the NSP program, there's like $2 million to run this program. This is craziness. We need to be much more efficient than that in getting these dollars on the street, because we're not giving it to the people that are really doing service delivery. It's just getting sucked into the void of City Hall. And it's just gotta stop. We gotta figure out how to do this right. And it just because we get a 20% allocation for administration doesn't mean we necessarily need to take the whole 20%. We need to get these dollars out on the street, helping people. And then we turn around and we cut 30% out of human services. A city is judged on how it treats its most vulnerable citizens. And frankly, we treat them very poorly. I don't think we're doing what we should be doing. We need to do this much more efficiently. if we need to open up for a $242,000 fine, we can look at that. But these numbers are just way, way too bloated to administer this program. I'm sorry, I've been saying it to people quietly for a long time, and it's time to be public about it, that we need to be much more efficient in the way we're administering these dollars. These are federal taxpayer dollars. Yeah, it's a pot of money that comes to the city, but this is still my tax dollars. And for it to be bloated in this fashion, we need to go back and look at this formula and make it much more efficient. Thank you.
Thanks. Councilmember Higgins?
This question seems silly after Councilmember Higgins. But hey, I just had a question about the extra 242. Is there any way this can be used to subsidize our dial-a-ride issues for our ADA population who is on the chopping block for much of our city?
With all due respect, Councilmember, I think those are the kind of backs and forth that I don't know that we're in a position right now to make those kind of things. I think as a rhetorical question, it's something that I think we can throw into the pot. I think what we've heard today is this needs a little bit more, I don't want to use the word study, but I think we need some more discussion on this in the details. We're not in a position right now to start talking about $50 here and $5,000 here, even $100,000 here and there. I think, though, that we probably need to follow up. I think Councilmember Richens has some very specific questions that he wants to follow up with. And what I would suggest is that we take action on the two recommendations as to the general nature and how we want to proceed with the 242. And then we follow up with some very specific things and come back and report as part of the ongoing budget process. And I know, Mr. Brady, we're running up against some deadlines.
Well, and this is earlier than the other process. That's the problem.
I understand that. But I think there's some legitimate questions and issues that need to be followed up that go beyond what we can accomplish in this meeting today. And so we probably need to go. There are some basic questions that we have. Councilmember Richens.
Can I just humbly request in the future that you don't do this to us again? Don't push us up against the deadline that we have to make a decision where we don't get an opportunity to study it for a couple more weeks if we need it.
Okay, we have until May 7th. We haven't said you're not making a decision next week.
Good.
You're not making a decision today. That's why we're doing this now.
What I would suggest is that you have some very specific questions and issues. We need to get together with Mr. Brady and come back in a couple weeks, and let's come back with some a follow-up report if we can. But we need to take action on the two recommendations. I heard Councilmember Summers, do you want to reform that as a motion on the two alternatives?
Let me find my alternatives. I believe it was option number two. Do we need a motion, or can we just provide
just direction? That's fine.
Just direction?
I think if it's direction, then I'd recommend, Mayor, that we open the process up for option number two.
Okay, so the two options were that the $242,000 specifically either be limited to the existing applicants and we just go back to the existing applicants. That's option number one. Option number two is that we open it up through a new RFP to additional or different applicants, and the existing applicants can still reapply, but that we open it up for potential different uses. Okay, Councilman Richens?
There's some unfunded projects in the existing pool that I think I'd rather see funded right now, and I'm going to name one in particular. It's the Save the Family application to rehab their 52 housing units. For a long time, Save the Family has been doing a very poor job in how they maintain their affordable housing units in my neighborhood. And it's getting old, frankly. And I'm not in a position, I noticed they're getting another $200,000 in, or $225,000 to acquire more affordable housing, presumably in one of our neighborhoods. They don't take care of their units. I've encouraged them to rehab their units. We didn't fund that fully. There's $120,000, they need $180,000 to do it. I don't want any excuses from them. I want them to have all the money that they're asking for. I want those units rehabbed. It'll do more to revitalize parts of West Mesa than any other project that we can do. And, you know, so there's unfunded sections in the current applications that I think deserve some funding before we start opening dollars back up.
Well, they can come back, and that can be part of the all we're saying is if there's one, two, or whatever, we want to that all the difference between number one and number two is not that you're going to shut out the existing ones, but that if there is something else that we want to bring in or that we want to allow to come in, that can come in. So we could decide and the staff could decide to take the $242,000 and put it to existing applicants.
Okay, so let me be clear what you're saying.
We're not foreclosing out that opportunity. So, my understanding is that correct?
Okay. So say they come back in, they say, hey, you know, we were underfunded by $60,000.
We could decide
project.
To do that.
We could decide. Yeah. Perfect. That's fine.
But also, if there was an economic development or something else or code or whatever it is, we could plug, squeeze that in. Whereas we can't do that if we just go to existing.
Okay.
All right. Any problems with going with number two? I think that's the direction.
Thank you.
I'd like to say one quick thing. I can understand Councilmember Richens' frustrations. He and I have talked a lot about that because there are a lot of questions. It's also frustrating because of the level of city support that has gone into the human services area over the last few years. That's frustrating, I think, for a lot of people, for everybody. I would say this. As I talk to fellow mayors and people from other cities, our city is blessed with one of the most mature social service networks in the entire state. I mean, when you look at the agencies that have been started here, have grown here, have matured here, such as a New Leaf, such as Mark, such as Save the Family, Child Crisis, and the list goes on and on, Sunshine Acres, those kind of things, we are very unique, and I think we need to understand that on an overall basis, we do an incredible job. What that also does is that our relationship between the city and providing those services is very different than what you see in other cities. Many cities don't have that mature network, and the city itself is the provider. And they have huge staffs, and they provide those services. We truly do have a partnership, and I think it's been Councilmember Kavanaugh and others have mentioned this. We truly do have a partnership here in Mesa. And that's both incredibly advantageous, but it also creates some challenges as we lean on each other or look to each other to provide these the financial wherewithal to provide these services. And sometimes it's a little bit easier in our community to sort of lay it off to the social agencies when we have, as a city, vested interests. And when I say vested interest, there are things that we have social agencies do that save us as a community money, and it's a great investment, whether it be Child Crisis, East Valley Men's Shelter, where we would have no choice but to provide those services. If we have if we have someone on the street that the police have to pick up, they've got to go somewhere. And we can either choose to have that police officer off the street for an entire day while they book them or take them somewhere, or they can take them down to East Valley Men's Shelter and East Valley Minchiller picks it up and the police officer's back on the street. That, to me, is a good investment. And we have that opportunity here in Mesa. So as this discussion goes forward, I hope we put it in the context of we have a great network. It's really strained right now. I think we all get that. I think we understand that. And the reality is, and this is the harsh reality we deal with, everybody in this economy is going through the same problems. Social agencies are getting a huge uptick in their demands for their services at the same time that their normal donors are getting hit, and so the private donations are going down. The initial urge is all of a sudden to reach to government to fill that gap. The reality is resources aren't there. We're going through the same thing that everyone else is, and we have to deal with that reality. That's just the way it is. Wish it would be different. I would love for it to be different, but the resources in the economy as a whole, which means in the city as a whole, just are not there. This is not a matter of can we afford it. The matter is we have to look at different ways and tweaking the ways that we interact and do things as a government. And I think the expectations of what even our city government can do have got to be adjusted because that's the reality we live in. I wish it were different, but it's not. And balancing that is going to be our challenge over the next couple of 3 weeks as we look at these. You know, I know we're talking about $1 billion budget, but I also realize that $1,000 to an agency is a make or break proposition. So I don't want to minimize the importance of the decisions we have to make. So, we're blessed to have the agencies and the social network we have. We also have real challenges and real issues. So come back in a couple of weeks, talk with Councilmember Richens, if you'd get with Mr. Brady, and let's bring the items that you've talked to and see what we can do to get more services out into the streets so we can grow as a community. Thank you. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
All right, the next item is fire department, chapter 2. It's like deja vu all over again.
Right.
Okay, Chief, I think we were slide number 9?
10.
Okay, we're starting on slide 10 then.
Slide 10, yes.
All righty. Thank you,
Mayor.
For coming back, by the way.
Absolutely.
I appreciate that.
My privilege. Morning, Mayor, members of the council. I want to start off by thanking Ray for getting everybody's juices flowing this morning, so we can have a very interactive discussion here on some of the fire issues. Again, as the mayor said, we're going to begin with slide number 10. It's kind of a quick recap of what we've already covered, and I'm going to be very high level about this. I don't want to discourage, obviously, any questions or anything, and we can go back to the other slides. They're still in the packet here if you want to refer back to them. But in essence, the first part of the presentation indicated that over the next 18 months, the fire department is in a position to have to reduce its budget by $7.5 million. We have implemented 10 action plans, of which the slides are addressing each of the items of the action plan. They're primarily focused on getting the TRV program in place and making it functional, and minimizing some of the difficulties that could occur through implementing a separate system as we've implemented here in Mesa. And then one last little point on that is each of the items of this plan are integrated and interdependent. So if we fail to successfully implement any one of these items, we're going to compromise the ability of us to actually succeed in the TRV program as a whole. So with that, let's move on to slide 11 and talk briefly about department training, one of the action plan items. As you recall, a major portion of the budget reduction that we've experienced has been in our overtime. One of the ways we've been able to accomplish that is through implementing what we call battalion level training rather than department training. That process is saving us over $200,000 in overtime, and that's been eliminated, and we have actually expanded our training into the field. We're using, as you can see in the picture, our community rooms and any other space we have at the fire stations to try to congregate our crews in the field in an in-service capacity so that they can attend essentially the classroom components of the training that we have to continually involve ourselves with. Obviously, we still need the field exercise items, and that is going to take us out of service, but the out-of-service time will be much lower, thus strengthening response times and accomplishing the training at the same time. One of the difficulties in this process is maintaining consistency. When you decentralize something to this extent, especially when you consider the nature of our work, we need to be trained consistently across the board so that each crew understands what the other crew is going to do, and the language is the same, the procedures are the same, so it's pretty critical that consistency be maintained. One of the ways we're looking to do that is using a video conferencing system, which Council approved on Monday night. Thank you very much. Again, an important cog in this whole process to accomplishing the TRV program and saving the dollars. We really believe that the video conferencing is really probably pretty much overdue, but economically it's come into focus as something that's very doable nowadays. And I would like to thank our shift commanders and our battalion chiefs and captains and our training staff for really engaging in this as a major change in the way we do training in the fire department. And training is a huge issue for us in the fire department, as you would imagine. So,
Chief, I think Councilmember Higgins has a question.
Thanks, Mayor. Chief, I just wondered, when you were talking about training, did we ever look at computer or internet conferencing as opposed to the big video conferencing that we approved last week? You know, where you have your internet meetings, your internet training, where it's the $20 camera on top of your computer, which everybody has on their desktop, and you can communicate, train all through the internet?
Yes, Councilmember Higgins, we have used computer-based training for some time, mostly for our recertification processes that are mostly dependent upon classroom time. But we've been doing that in addition to our department-level training. So that process will continue and expand, but we still need the ability through video conferencing to have direct contact with interaction and question-answer to help get true education and training across.
Yeah, what I'm saying is that can now happen through the internet with
video link meetings that don't actually require all that initial equipment. So I'm told from people who work in the field.
And in addition to that, in the fire stations, there is not a computer terminal for each firefighter to be able to sit down at the same time. Okay. There's usually one or two. And if it's an internet-based conference call and they were to get a call and be called out into service, then they would miss the remainder of that particular training. In the battalion level training, if they're called out onto a call, when they return, they can pick up where they left off.
Sure, great.
But I think your point's well made that we're going to explore every technical opportunity we can to enhance our training capabilities, no question.
Chief, Councilmember Summers has a question.
On Councilmember Higgins' issue, too, there isn't necessarily a direct correlation between being in a classroom and being cognitively connected to what the instructor has to say. And in fact, with a lot of the young folks who are coming into the fire service right now, internet-based learning or distance learning or iPod-based learning, the asymmetric or asynchronous learning methods, as long as they're supported by some kind of testing and then it's competency-based instruction, it provides wonderful opportunities for the fire service, given call volumes and alarms, to provide a consistent level of training to everybody. Randomized testing provides that assurance that they're learning, and as long as they're passing that test, then they're delivering that training. Doesn't work in every aspect. You can't lay canvas and test a cruise competency and fire attack without bringing them down to the academy and actually have them pull the hose off the truck. But for some aspects of that classroom-based training, what Councilmember Higgins is referring to is something that fire service should be looking at and has been looking at for some time. It's been quite successful, and it seems as, again, the younger folks are adapting to it quite well, so we should continue to pursue that. And the materials that we bought, the infrastructure we bought for video conferencing, some of that can be used to put this online. So I would encourage the fire department and the police department, for that matter, to continue to look at that level of training. Mm-hmm.
iPod-based training?
iPod-based. It's you wouldn't believe the stuff my son can download.
No, I'm just thinking of the, you know.
Some of it he gets in trouble for.
You got the earphones in, you say, tell my wife, no, I'm just in training.
I'm in training.
Yes, you does that now.
I tried that, but she's not believing that for me.
Okay, next item.
Hey, Mayor, the next item has to do with our fire and life safety education areas. We have, as we've mentioned before, expanded some training. Actually, we have great plans to expand our training for 911 access education, as well as doing a little better job in what we're going to call emergency medical service prevention, where we can begin to focus on, I think at this point, mostly the seniors with regard to fall injuries and the kinds of things that really we anticipate to go up as the population ages. And we'll obviously expand that program very flexibly into every aspect of accident prevention that we can that involves our citizens. We're doing that in large part through partnerships with various agencies that we haven't explored before, and we're also looking very closely at sponsorships to help us fund certain aspects of this training where we can partner with members of the community who have an interest in taking an active role in some of the safety training that we're involved with. We're also in the process, as we talk about expanding the volunteer program, of recruiting for our connector program. And if I could just take a moment to thank Councilmember Kavanaugh for his support with regard to this program as the person really that initiated the program many years ago. We did see an issue, as Mayor mentioned earlier, everybody's suffering from the economic consequences. And so some of the partners we've had in the past were beginning to feel like they wouldn't be able to continue with the program. And through Councilmember Kavanaugh's support and some support from Councilmember Summers, they have come back to the table, and I'm talking, and additional participants, including United Way, have stepped forward to help us not only maintain our connector program, but potentially strengthen it. So it's really turned out to be a very good partnership that has been reinvigorated here recently. We plan to continue, obviously, working with those partners. We want to expand the program. As we mentioned before, we want to begin to train connectors to deal with a broader range of service issues. So at some point, they may be able to actually take some of the call volume that we currently send fire trucks on that don't require four people, that they would be able to service them as a sole responder. Obviously, that's a pretty tricky endeavor. But again, in terms of this being an integrated system approach, I think we're going to be just fine with this approach.
Chief, we really need to keep moving. We've got a lot of
Let's move on. Okay. If we move on to the next slide, in the fire bonds. Just let me note before let's just move right into fire bonds. You can see that we have several bond projects in various phases of completion. Really only two points to make here. One is to thank council for approval for our construction of Station 218 and for the property purchase for Station 220. That's really a great progress. You know, we haven't initiated construction of a new fire station in Mesa for at least 6 or 7 years. So this is a huge step for us, and we feel very invigorated by that. I also want to just take a quick moment to thank Engineering, Real Estate, and Procurement Services for the work they've done, because we've really accelerated this thing. Somebody said once, we'll never be able to build two fire stations in the city of Mesa at the same time. It just doesn't have the capacity. And I think that what we've shown here is that there's a lot of energy to be progressive, and I appreciate their work on that. At this point, we want to...
Chief?
Yeah, just make a quick comment. I noticed one of your last bullet points on the fire bonds was acquiring land for station or evaluating land at Broadway and Longmore for a second acquisition. I just want to encourage us whenever we can to couple a revitalization need with a fire station location, because there's a lot of blighted property and vacant property down in there. And so at any time that we can accomplish two goals at once is a great thing. So I just wanted to have you keep that in mind.
And through your previous support, I think we did that for Station 218. So I appreciate
that. Yeah, it was
that.
A great collaboration working on that.
Was.
Thank you.
I have with me, my left is Chief Jim Bloomer, who is a battalion chief that we reassigned from staff here recently because of the budget reductions, who has considerable experience in the emergency management department or division for us managing grants. And so we have, what would you call it, kidnapped him from his current assignment and placed him on staff for a limited period of time to really get into the research and development of some of the grants that the stimulus package has brought on. So I want to let Jim give you a brief rundown on the grant situation at this point.
Okay, Mr. Mayor, council members. Homeland Security grants, the Urban Area UASI grants, State Homeland Security Metropolitan Medical Response System, those are standard grants that we've been receiving monies on for approximately the last 7-8 years, and we have additional funding coming in on that. Wanted to get to the next page here. Basically, primary fire service grant opportunities. These are also grants that come that repeat each year, the SAFER grant, the Fire Act grant, and fire prevention grants. We are looking over all of these and wanting to apply for them as, you know, as needed. Currently, the Fire Act grant has opened. The guidelines were released this last week. One of the things that we're looking at, we have until May 20th to apply on that, is a driving simulator for the fire department. By acquiring this, I mean, this would save us wear and tear on our vehicles and also save us money on fuel and maintenance costs. Federal stimulus grant opportunities. As we're all aware, I mean, there's a lot of money floating around out there. We're sitting back waiting for a lot of the guidelines to come through. There's been $210 million that's been set aside for fire station construction and remodels. Currently at this time, no guidelines have been released. We've been touching base with a lot of people from Region 9 and on the national level trying to get information on that. We assume guidelines, or we've been told guidelines, will be coming forth this summer. And as they are, we're currently working. We have several, about 12 or 15 different projects identified as potential projects, and just depending on how the guidelines come forth, we'll be able to, you know, pick the best project to hopefully go after one of these. replace or eliminated sworn positions, have safer there in parentheses and stuff on this. Basically, you know, as you're aware, I mean, we're losing positions through attrition, and as we expand services through new fire stations and TRV programs and stuff, eventually, as Councilmember Jones pointed out on Monday, you know, we will need to hire. And we're totally tracking all possibilities, you know, for additional funding to, you know, to support that. Electronic exchange of health information. Currently, we're looking for software to support our money to support this money to support the software for our EPCRs, and there's safer monies coming down through the state that we may be able to, you know, tap in on some of that. Just depends on how the guidelines come forth and how the state wants to manage it. That particular money is coming through the Department of Health Services and stuff, but it does specifically state hospital communications, which we are working towards. So there's a lot of different opportunities, but once again, it just depends on how the guidelines are released as far as how we'll be able to move forward on that.
And I think as we've seen from the other grants and stimulus that we have, we know that the strings attached vary. So I applaud you for going after whatever is out there and recognizing that there's good money and there's troubling money.
Right.
So thank you for doing that.
Mayor, just one little point I'd like to add there is that obviously we don't have any staff to manage grants or apply for grants or administer grants. We simply do that with the Verdana's management team. But for this particular process, we have recruited volunteers from our department who would like to be involved in grant writing and administration process, and Jim's been able to drag a pretty strong team of people together, both from our field units as well as our staff people.
I'm starting to worry now, Chief. You kidnapped Jim. Now yes. You're dragging other people in.
Where there's a will, there's a way, Mayor.
Okay.
You know, and we plan to pull it off. So.
Mayor, we do have a grant coordinator.
Yeah.
So that there's
well,
always
but I understand resource. What the chief's saying. We're and it's great that you're getting using all the resources we can, and people are stepping up to go the extra mile.
Yeah,
so thank you
through Jim's leadership.
Thank you.
The next slide has to do with our regional EMS model. As you are aware, we have made an agreement with support from Mayor Smith and Mr. Brady, as well as the mayors and city managers from Gilbert and Queen Creek and the Apache Junction Fire District to pursue a regional ambulance contract where we can have seamless service for our ambulance service similar to the way we provide our fire service. You know, we have been, this is a model that we've used for years. Obviously, EMS is in terms of volume, the most demanding part of our job. And so we have integrated a model for years and years. The approach that we're taking with regard to the ambulance system is not been done in the state of Arizona before. There are some provisions in law that will allow this, we believe, that have not been interpreted or accessed in the past. One of the most important things we want to accomplish with this, as I mentioned earlier, is a seamless service model where we have consistency. Obviously, there are three basic players and stakeholders in this process. The cities are essentially the patient or citizen advocate in this process. The ambulance companies, their primary stakeholder position is that this is their business, obviously, and they need to make a profit. And then the third agency is the Arizona Department of Health Services, who regulates this whole process for the whole state. So we've been meeting with each of those primary stakeholders, getting their input. We do have some pushback, which we anticipated because we are embarking in an area that has not been tested before. But we really believe that not only for the day-to-day service, but for the future. If you, I probably don't need to remind you some of the chaos that's going on around the valley with regard to ambulance services and the mixing of various companies and the impact that has on service delivery. So we think we're on the right track with this. It ties right into our automatic aid system that we've used for EMS for 20 years. We see a potential for this part of the business to deteriorate, and we're trying to take preventative action. Plus, it just makes good sense economically. The larger we can work together as a partner in a region, we have a greater service demand, thus a little more profitability for a company who would want to provide us service. We can set our standards where we would like them with this sort of competition. So we are involved in that right now. And we've been working very closely with the law department, and we're working our way through that. Again, it's just one component of our EMS system, but it's very critical, especially as we look into the future.
Okay, Chief, I think Councilmember Kavanaugh has a question.
Thank you. Just a question and a comment. I know back in January, we, at a study session, we gave direction to go ahead to you and our city attorney to work on drafting the RFP for the communities to consider. And as you noted, there's lots of moving policy parts in this process. And so I guess my preference would be to ask either you and the city manager and city attorney to at least consider bringing the RFP back before the Public Safety Committee to review before we have final recommendations to send it out. Because as you noted, there are a lot of players in the mix and a lot of issues in the mix that are important in terms of affecting the community. And I think certainly I want to be very clear in terms of what it is exactly that we're putting out and for people to understand, because we talked about it in generalities a couple months ago, and I think we need to make sure we understand the specifics, if that's okay. Thank you, Mayor.
And I appreciate the work that has gone into it. I've talked to other mayors and everything, and everyone's excited about the potential for this new service model. We're also very much aware of some of the issues you brought up and that Councilmember Kavanaugh brought up, and I think we need to be careful that we don't rush into this without recognizing that we are in new territory, like you said. And there are, I can't remember how you described it, there is a hodgepodge of competing interests and stakeholders and everything. We just need to make sure that we get that. So if you want to work with Councilmember Kavanaugh and Mr. Brady, we can move forward with that. Any other questions for the Chief? Councilmember Fenter.
Thank you. Appreciate the presentation. Quickly, I would love to see for the future research and possible coming back to the council what we can do to address the frequent flyer program. And my comments are for both police department and fire department. As a legislative body, what I perceive the problem is out in Mesa is there are businesses and organizations that their business model relies heavily upon the public safety services that are provided to them. I'm hoping that we'll be able to research, really define the problem, and much like our fire alarm nuisance ordinance or others, be able to address that to be able to relieve some of the pressures that the different departments. Give an example, in 2008, a particular group home generated 36 calls for police service in a six-month period. That seems unusually high. That does take away police officers from the field. And I think fire has some of those issues with assisted living facilities that don't staff appropriately and sometimes literally just need fire department personnel to come put people back in bed. And I appreciate the reinvention that's going on in the department to look at how we deliver that service in a more efficient manner. So I hope we don't miss a component of that legislative portion that we can possibly help both our police and fire department doing. So thank you, Mayor.
And thank you. And I might be a little bit more blunt. There are people out there who abuse our system and to and use it as part of what they should be providing, or else they use it for a myriad of non-emergency issues. And the days when we had the resources that we could accommodate that are past. I mean, and this is, gets back to what I said before in human services. We have got to change, in many ways, our expectations of what our governments at all levels can provide us. And I would support that also to look into areas where there are chronic abusers of the system, those businesses and individuals who frequently call us and ask our very expensive and very well-trained people to come out to basically do their dirty work for them has got to stop. And we got to figure out a way that if they want that they either compensate the other citizens of Mesa, because they are taking from other citizens, either through a reduction of service or an actual cost. And we need to, in fairness to everybody, we need to deal with that somehow. And I don't know what the answer is, but I'd love you to get the information as to whether it is really a problem. And if it is really a problem, maybe some suggestions we can talk about as we go forward as to how we can mitigate that problem. Okay.
Mayor, Councilmember Fincher, obviously we are aware, acutely aware of some of the issues that you've represented. And we've looked at alternatives to dealing with some of those. One, I would be remiss if I didn't mention that we had actually Mesa Fire sponsored an education program for assisted living centers, which we had pretty good turnout for. And we almost immediately began to see a significant reduction in the number of calls to the facilities that participated in that. So some of it is education, but I do believe you're correct that there are some, and quite frankly, there are some laws that that don't require the level of care that maybe they should. But what we do see is anytime we have a concentration of citizens, we're going to see a high volume of call.
Right.
And so, you know, you're aware of the issues, and I appreciate you bringing the subject up. Yeah. And we'd be more than happy to
let's
put together
talking,
some research for you.
Let's just keep talking about it, and you can, you know, work with the public safety committee to come back with, you know, and there may not be as big a problem as we think. There may be a bigger problem. I agree with Councilmember Fender. I'd at least like to look at it.
Be happy to. Thank you.
Because to me, that's part of our ever-changing and evolving service model.
Certainly is.
Okay, thank you very much.
Okay, thank you.
Appreciate it. Next item on the agenda is here from the police department. Why don't we take a five-minute break while the police department is setting up, and then we'll be back to hear from the police department. So. Yeah, let's make it real quick. 5 minutes. Chiefs.
Mr. Mayor.
Welcome.
Thank you. Would you like me to start, or would you like to wait for the two missing members?
Didn't even see the Vice Mayor and Councilmember Kavanaugh.
Debbie, yeah. Check the men's room.
He's coming shortly. I certainly hope so.
Are we the four?
Here comes the Vice Mayor. Okay, let's go ahead and get started then.
Okay, good morning, Mr. Mayor, council members. I understand that we have some time constraints, so we're going to move very quickly, and then if you have any questions, we'll be glad to go back. What we're going to do today is we're going to cover several areas. Chief Mace is going to be talking about some operational issues. Chief Dvorak will be talking about some support service areas, and then Ms. Quiddens will be talking about some grants and some funding concerns. As you can see by the first slide that we have here, and I'm not going to read it to you. Those are the areas that we intend to cover today. And again, if you have any questions there, feel free to stop me. Next, just a very quick overview of the financial picture. As you can see there, you see the dollar amounts. They have been reduced from our budget, both for the fiscal year 2008-2009, and then for 2009-2010. And you can see the totals on the bottom is about a little over $6 million for the current fiscal year, and that will climb to approximately $13 million for the following fiscal year. Also, I think it's important to note, if you notice a little footnote there, is that we, with the help of Mr. Brady, I believe that we have been able to negotiate some funding coming from the Mesa Gateway Airport that will help us pay for core overtime. One of the areas that is impacting our morale and it's impacting our operations is the fact that we've had a significant reduction in overtime. If you look at the typical, especially the typical patrol officer pay, their pay has been reduced the 2% that all of us took. But in addition to that, police officers, like firefighters, depend a great deal on overtime pay. And for many of our officers, that has been anywhere from 3% to as high as 10%. So you're talking about some people that have in essence, suffered pay cuts that are as high as 10 to 12%. We hope that this money that Mr. Brady was able to provide will alleviate some of that for our patrol officers because it's having a double impact. It's having an impact, obviously, in the reduction in pay, but also it's taking people away from being in the field because when they go to court, we have a 40-hour and out policy, basically. So it's taking a substantial number of people from the field. Having said that, I will turn it over to Chief Mesa, who will start talking about deployment issues and crime numbers, and then we'll be moving down the line.
Good morning, Mayor and Council. I want to touch on some of the areas that we had changed at the beginning of the process for the first quarter. And the first one is the decentralization of our traffic unit. What we did is we decentralized 28 traffic personnel and assigned them to each district, where each district received 6 officers and 1 sergeant. Their purpose was to maintain their traffic enforcement focus, but it also put those dedicated resources out to the districts and made them accountable to the districts to be utilized in other situations if necessary to help with patrol if necessary, but still maintain their focus on traffic. I do warn that it's probably too early in the first quarter to gauge the decentralization. However, I did want to go over some of the information that we are seeing in the first quarter through the decentralization. Number one thing is our accidents in the city of Mesa continue to decline. We're at about a 14% decrease in traffic accidents. We've seen a continual decrease overall in injury accidents in 06, 07, 08. We're still seeing that. Driver behavior has been impacted. We're seeing less accidents. We're seeing about a 25% reduction in photo red light violations. Now, that involves a lot of things: driver behavior, engineering of intersections, people finding out, realizing where these intersections where the red lights cameras are. But altogether, we are seeing that reduction in the traffic accidents. In this quarter, our traffic resources were impacted slightly by we had four officers that were off and not on duty due to either injury or military duty, so that did impact as we were comparing our first quarter of 08 to 09. But what we did is we took the core officers that were motor officers that were working in 08 and the core officers, 22 officers in 09, and evaluated their performance. And in 08, they were averaging in a quarter 130 citations in a quarter, and in this quarter, they're averaging 148 citations. So our core motor officers are writing more citations under the decentralization. However, our overall city sites are down, and that's impacted by several other things that Chief mentioned. You know, the 40 and out, if you have court for 10 hours, you're not going to be on the street for that 10 hours, and that's less arrests, less sites, things like that. So just wanted to give you a picture of our traffic. Traffic is handling more accidents this quarter than last quarter. Now, remember, our accidents are down, but they're handling more of them, which means they're taking that burden off of patrol, and that was one of our goals that we wanted to do. So they're taking more patrol accidents from patrol officers. The next area I wanted to cover was our FAST team, which was our full-time SWAT team that we decentralized and put back out on the road. We have, after further review, we had no loss of coverage for city council meetings with our FAST officers. And the purpose was to maintain their SWAT focus while putting those dedicated resources back out into the districts. They're still available for SWAT call-outs, and this is something that's been significant. In 08, for the first quarter, they handled zero calls for service for patrol. This quarter, they've assisted 243. So that is one of the things that we wanted, and we are seeing out their resource out there handling calls for service for patrol. Comparing the last quarter of 08, they had 36 call-outs. Compared to this quarter, we've had 44. So we've seen an increase in their call-outs over the last two quarters. However, their overtime has decreased by 46% from last quarter to this quarter, from 974 hours to 525. And that's a combination of what type of calls they're going out to. You can get called out to something that lasts for 5 hours compared to something that lasts for a half hour. But we are trying to manage the amount of resources coming out to the calls and still maintaining the safety factor with our set teams. The utilization of our street crime units and gang units, those are resources that are at the district that aren't necessarily on a patrol focus. However, what our lieutenants will do, lieutenants come in every day or every night of their shift, and they evaluate what manpower that they have, what resources they have for that shift. We have our basic staffing levels. If they are under those basic staffing levels, they'll reach out to other stations, or they'll start looking at what other unit resources are available, like street crime units and like gang units, and they will call on those units to help cover the streets during peak hours or peak times of activity, and then allow those units to go back and do their focus. So I'll tell you, every night's a chess game when we're looking at our resources, because we're moving pieces around, we're seeing what we have available. So I do give the lieutenants a lot of credit for managing that to ensure we have proper amount of resources out on the street at those times. Talk about staffing levels, and just to give you some numbers as far as the first quarter of 08, and I'll give you a patrol division picture, and then I'll give you an actual patrol officer picture. When I say the division, that includes street crime units, gang units, detectives, and so on. In the first quarter of 2008, we had allocated 557 to the patrol operations division, and then assigned was 516. So we had a shortage of 47 in 08. In 09, we had allocated 574, and a lot of those numbers were the motors going out to the streets, the set units. and we had actual assigned 541, so a shortage of 33. So our shortage has actually, as an overall division operations, has decreased. Now, talk about boots on the streets. When you talk about patrol, in 08 we had 343 allocated. We had 324 assigned, which is a shortage of 21. And in the first quarter of 09, we had 339 allocated and 321 assigned, so a shortage of 18. That shortage has shrunk for this quarter compared to last quarter. And the reasons for that is in November we had a class. We had a class of recruits that graduated FTO, so that gave us a shot in the arm of 20 officers. I do want to warn you, though, we did eliminate a lot of vacancies, so those vacancies were relevant to the last quarter. As we start losing positions now up until our goal of 773?
Roughly, approximately 770 from the 855, 56 that we had.
We will see those numbers start to shrink.
Looking at approximately 80 officers that we would lose by the, if we follow the current budgeting scheme for the next 18 months. Now, we'll pick up about 25 if the stimulus package, if we get granted those 25, but we'll still be somewhere approximately 50 officers less than we had a year ago, and some that obviously council is going to have to evaluate in the future.
Now, Chief, those are positions. We've never quite always had those. Is that the average field is what's we've carried an average of how many vacancies per year for the last 3 or 4 years? About 40 or so?
It probably averages about 50 a year. 45
yeah.
to 50 a year.
So we're essentially shrinking a lot of that funded, but we're trying to keep close, although it's going to be pressure to keep the same number out in the field. As far as total authorized, it will definitely shrink.
Yeah, it's very difficult to come up to the fully authorized number because you always have people leaving and people coming. So,
and that's why at the first quarter we had a focus of patrol because we knew that these numbers were going to shrink and we wanted to try to maintain, you know, the direct services. On the other hand, where we are seeing shrinkages are on our, you know, like the FAST team, they were serving warrants, they were doing surveillance for other units, so we have lost that. So we're trying to balance the resources to not lose anything out in the street.
Our Chief, I'm sorry, you just mentioned something that perked me up. The warrant situation, how are we progressing on serving warrants with the FAST team doing other work? Because that's
right.
been an issue countywide.
We have our major felony unit, and which was highlighted at a press conference a couple weeks ago, which is doing outstanding work when it comes to felony, serious crime warrants. We have one warrant officer, and we've had one warrant officer for the last year. We're moving an officer from our VSIT, which is our gun squad, over to assist that officer. So we're adding an officer to that. Doesn't mean that we've lost the focus of warrants, but the FAST team was there to assist the warrant officer if needed. But we did lose, you know, that resource, but we haven't lost the focus on warrants.
We tracking our warrants, the number of warrants that we're responsible for, and how many?
Well, we have, and there's also, you know, we have been fortunate enough by housing the East Valley Warrant Task Force that is headed by the Marshal's Office in the city of Mesa has made a significant difference in our ability to go after the worst of the worst concerning Mesa.
Who's participating in that? It's Mesa, the U.S. Marshals.
U.S. Marshal, Mesa, we have Tempe, Chandler, Gilbert. I'm not sure if Scottsdale is on at this point. DPS now is coming on board. We have the probation department working with us. Also, another thing is that, you know, we're sending down a lot of warrants, especially misdemeanor warrants, to the stations. On the first quarter of this year, we served 3,000 warrants in the city. So we're trying to look for other ways to overcome the shortcomings. But I think it's important to realize that, you know, there is a limit to efficiencies, and at some point, you know, you're cutting into the bone. You know, we're going to be severely impacted by 2011-2012, And it's important for council to realize the hiring and training cycle of a police officer. It takes about 5 years to have a fully functional police officer. It takes about, on a good day, it takes 6 months to hire one. It takes about a year of training when you consider 6 months in the academy and 6 months in the field. At that point, you're going to be closer to 2 years, and you still don't have really a solid street cop. It takes another 2 to 3 years. So we're looking for different models. We're adding civilians components that we believe are going to reduce the workload for police officers so that we can alter the model. But I think it's important in the future, and I recognize that there are budgetary problems today, but I think it's important in the future that council be aware and start planning for how we're going to staff policing in the city 3 years down the line. Because 3 years down the line, when you open up the faucet and you say, go higher, you're not going to see those people fully functional for another three. So it's not a, you don't turn the light switch off and on. So it's important to consider that. Also, I just came from Washington where we had a meeting with the Attorney General, and we're looking at funding for policing in the future. And Eric Holder was very clear. The president is telling him, once this round of money is put out there, there are going to be significant reductions because the president intends to start looking at balancing the budget. So all the cops money that you see going out there, that's not likely to be repeated again. So we have to consider that we will be hiring and paying in full for whatever we hire 3-4 years down the line.
Next slide. Talk about the crime picture, which is really what we focus on. What is our crime picture in our community? In the first quarter, we're happy to say that we have a 13% reduction in Part 1 crimes. So we're continuing to see the crime reductions. Something that we highlight and discuss, and I don't want to jinx us, but we have not had a homicide in the first quarter of 09. Yes, thank you.
Haven't had a homicide for almost 6 months.
Yeah.
It's first time since 1981.
And our major felony unit, we've had zero homicides. They've arrested 14 homicide suspects in the first quarter, and that's where I talk about we're targeting the worst of the worst. We just arrested a homicide suspect that came to Mesa that committed a homicide in Prescott 2 days ago. So we're very, very proud of that particular unit. And then just touch real quick on the warrants. We also participate in a committee that's looking at warrant process and how warrants are purged, how long they're in the system, and things like that to look at the process on warrants. One of the rise that we're seeing is in aggravated assaults. When in analyzing that, we're seeing a rise in our domestic violence aggravated assaults. And we're glad to see that we're finally, this is the first time in 2 years that we're seeing a reduction in our robberies. We're sitting at 22% reduction in robberies right now. Just real quick, I want to highlight something that's come out, a program which is called Citizen Observer, which we did a press conference on about 3 weeks ago. Citizen Observer is a system where we can get out information to the public and receive crime information and tips. We just really started kicking it off, and we're still in the process of trying to market it. But we've had 31 total public alerts so far, 2,511 total emails delivered by the system. We have 886 total text messages sent by the system. And I know this doesn't sound a lot, but it is. Five actionable tips received. So we've received five, but that's just the start. We hope that number continues to grow as we move on.
And the only marketing was the press conference, Mr. Mayor, that we held together. So far, we're getting ready to really start marketing.
I think we just started doing some stuff on Channel 11.
We have plans
literally in the last couple of days is all.
Yeah, we're going to start handing out. We have some cards that we'll hand out at community meetings. We're working with businesses to maybe do some advertising on their
for that kind of activity, and with virtually, as the chief said, virtually nothing other than the initial rollout is pretty good. So. Councilmember Fenter?
Just along the lines of deployment, I appreciate that presentation and anticipated a lot of the questions that I've had and the concerns, and I've taken every opportunity to share those over there with senior staff when I can. With regard to, just to let you know, and maybe you could touch base on it, last 2 weeks as a council member received complaints from citizens in District 2 about the long response times, and they were specifically, one was a very low priority call, and the other was a private property accident. And so trying to educate the public out there and kind of a different look at how we do things with the limited resources we have, and I appreciate that what we're going through, but it would be nice as we go through this process down the road to, I know that you're keenly aware, watching for key indicators on how the boots in the street are being affected by a pretty lean model as far as how we're delivering services, and really appreciate watching that closely and getting us some feedback. And there may be a decision as a legislative body down the road to be able to say this is or isn't working. And I appreciated Chief Gascon's presentation last time that we're in some uncharted territory and we're trying to figure out what works and what doesn't. And again, I appreciate the sensitivity of really watching that closely and you know, addressing some of the concerns I have. So thanks, Mayor.
Vice Mayor Jones.
Chief, with all the reallocation of resources, which is a huge challenge nonetheless, how are we on action team activity? I know that we never did get it grown to where we would have liked to because of restrictive resources, but are we still able to function the action team because it's so effective in what we're trying to accomplish in certain areas of properties and so forth?
Let me give you a general statement, and I'll turn it over to Chief Mesa. The answer is yes. We're still doing a lot of quality of life work, and we're looking for, you know, other models to try to enhance our ability to do so. One of the things that we're hoping is the civilian investigators, which Chief DeWara will give you a further presentation on, as they continue to evolve, and we're hoping that the benefit or the dividends from that will be that we'll have additional time for our sworn police officers to do what I would call more of the wholesale policing, which is, you know, high presence in public places, dealing with public nuisances, a lot of contact with the community. So we're in the process of finding the leveling point, but we are very conscious of the need to do that kind of work. I can tell you I'm a strong believer in the level of community policing, and we're looking for every way possible to get there. And I'll turn it over to Chief Mesa for some more details.
There's several things. We have street crime units. We have 3 street crime units at each district, and each one will play a different role. However, at any time, they all should be community action officers if the need arises where they have to really go out and do problem solving. What we do have is Red Mountain has a dedicated community action team that works with other city organizations and outside, you know, intervention. But they're not just, they do projects all over the city. Each station has a dedicated community action officer who is kind of a liaison and a catalyst to the street crime units. That's the person that can, you know, go to the meetings and meet with the neighbors. But if there's action that needs to be done, they have those resources at the stations that they can utilize. So we have not lost focus of that. I think we just have tried to make it more diverse.
I just want to make sure that we don't lose that interaction with other city agencies because it's so critical and effective in what we've been able to do.
Definitely.
Absolutely. Okay, next I'd like to turn it over to Chief Dvorak, and he's going to start his presentation with 287G training.
Good morning, Mayor, members of council. I'll give you a quick update on the 287G training, and for a little sense of perspective, I want to give you a brief history of some key dates just to give you some background. October 2006, the City Council discussed legal immigration reform issues and requested that the staff conduct additional research on the 287G program. In March 2008, a request was submitted to develop an MOU with ICE to train up to 10 detention officers. In June 2008, the mayor and city manager met with the ICE officials and facilitated a practice to clarify some of the transportation procedures related to that process. To bring you more current, a new class was scheduled at MCSO on March 16, 2009, and during that time, MESA was scheduled to send 40 detention officers to that training. March 13th, that class was canceled for reevaluation by ICE. March 2009, we've also been working with an agreement that was signed with ICE to put computers in our holding facility that will allow us that once we are 287G trained, that we've been able to proceed with some of those checks, but that is on hold currently with the 287G review going on. So until that training is obtained by our holding facilities staff, obviously we're not unable to connect that and be involved in that process.
Councilmember Summers, I think, has a question.
Chief, says the ICE training was canceled on March 15th. By whom? Was that ICE? Was that us?
It was canceled by the federal government. The Department of Homeland Security is reevaluating the 287G program. There are discussions that are taking place with the Justice Department. It is very likely that when 287G program gets reapplied, it will be very different than the 287G program that we now know. Quite frankly, there will be probably significant differences. Now, more than likely, our model actually would be a good fit because we were looking for 287G trained people at our inside the jail, and more than likely said that will be what you will see.
What's the support that ICE is providing to us right now? We still have an ICE agent that's embedded with Mesa PD and cooperative agreement. One of our detectives is still there.
It's the other way around. Okay. We have had a Mesa officer embedded in ICE since September of 2006. When I first came here, I met with the then SAC of ICE, and we worked on an agreement, and we place a detective at that time. That detective continues to be there, working major cases. Just on the asset forfeiture area alone, some of the partnerships have yielded nearly, well, actually in excess of $400,000. Some of the money's not here yet, but it's pending, and we're working major cases and are continuing to do so.
And one last question. Has this impacted the new policy that the council approved last year, any with our officers?
None at all. Frankly,
has it been implemented?
The policy is fully implemented. I think also it's important to recognize as technology moves forward, and if ICE develops different business models, will we have access to the information that we need to have access to, regardless of the 287G training? What you may see in the future is that the value of that training may not be what it is today. Because we would have access to that same level of information. So I wouldn't be surprised if you start seeing different models, because the key for us is having access to the information at the holding facility, and I think we're getting very close to having that direct access. Today we have the access. We just have to go through an interim process with ICE. So our policy is fully operational. We're averaging just under 10% because we now track it. Of all the arrests that we made are people that are here without authority, and that has been very consistent for over a year now. You know, at least at this point, it appears that our policy is working well.
You just reminded me, I said that was the last question, but that fingerprint ID program that we had about 2 years ago now, or three?
Yeah.
Great piece of technology, sure. But I think the state connectivity wasn't working for us, and it still isn't working for it. We don't have that yet.
And actually, there's some good news. First of all, the bad news is the state connectivity is not working.
All right.
And they were holding us back also because of protocols. They were uncomfortable allowing that level of access in the field. Since then, they have evolved, and there are two things that are happening. Number one, they are comfortable providing that level of access in the field. And number two, they're in the process actually of allowing Mesa perhaps to become kind of a pilot and doing this on their own. So we're moving forward. Now, having said that, there are still some pieces that have to be put into place before the technology can work for us. I believe the last that I heard, and frankly, this is about 3 months, 2 months old information, so it may change, but we're looking at possibly by the end of this year actually having the ability to have that technology in the field.
And for those who don't remember, either on this council or those playing the home game, it was a fingerprint ID technology that could be used in the field that would uplink to computers. And not, it was brought up in the context of immigration enforcement, having data access to the files of folks who are here illegally. But it was much broader than that because we can, all our officers, it was a safety issue because they could identify people, I don't have ID. Well, now you can put your thumbprint there, and if you're on record, have a warrant, and that would information would download. And it really would help reduce our Part 1 crimes. It would help arrest folks who have warrants. So it was I'm very interested in seeing that implemented.
If you recall, it's a model that I explained almost 3 years ago that we started to play within the LAPD. We wanted to do it here, and then we ran into a major stumbling block with the state. The technology is, quite frankly, not new technology. It's out there. It's just being able to do the hookups. But the importance of this tool would be that you would have the ability to determine if someone has been arrested before. If their fingerprints are on file, you will be able to determine their identity very quickly in the field. And that is a tremendous tool for law enforcement because, unfortunately, people lie to us often.
No. Thank you. Thank you, Chief Vice Mayor.
All right. Councilman Fender.
Thanks. As a follow-up, Chief, you said there probably may be a different model as far as the 287G training that we were going or anticipating sending folks to. What would be the plan B on that? You mentioned maybe you were looking for detention staff is there a plan to try and hire already previously trained, or just maybe the different model won't require that?
No, first of all, our request has always been to train people in the detention facility. We had never anticipated putting people with 27G trained in the field.
Right.
Some of the concepts that are being floated around in D.C. is that there will be a restriction of the program and more center at the detention prison facilities.
Well, Chief, as I understand that originally that's sort of how it was evolving, wasn't it?
That was the creation of the program. The program was never intended to be used in the field. It was really a program to be used at prisons and jails to reduce population in those settings and lower cost. It morphed into what it is today as a result of other activities. But the other point that I was making is as the technology increases and the availability to access the information by law enforcement increases, because right now that information is very limited in the field, you will have less need to have that level of training because it will work more like any other NCIC run that we do where you determine if somebody has a warrant or not. You will be able to determine very quickly from a field setting whether somebody has an illegal reentry want or warrant, so that process is moving forward, and the improvement in the biometrics in order to identify people also is moving forward very rapidly. Mm-hmm. So what you're going to see is you're going to see technology and new systems kind of sort of overtaking what are some limitations today, because even when you have 287G people trained in the field today, they cannot access the databases from the field many times, so they're relying and their interrogation of the suspect. And that is one of the areas that has led to many complaints.
And Chief, just to summarize, because we all know this is a hot topic, and we all know that there's a lot of things thrown around. I think this council and this city and your department has for a long time never shied away from enforcing immigration law, because it's part of our overall crime situation. We have our program, we have our objective, we have not wavered from that. We are hoping that 287G would fit into that. Our, as I understand it, our immigration efforts are not completely keyed on one program or another. And what I'm hearing from you is that with or without 287G, our objective still stays the same. We will adapt to whatever resources are out there. Right now, we don't have 287G in our detention facilities, but we still work with ICE. We work with MCSO in their jail facilities to process those, because those are part of our objective. As new technologies come out, we will implement those technologies, those processes, those procedures to fit in with our overall objective, which we indicated this council did in the policy we adopted last July, which is that we're committed to doing this. We have our program, which we believe works well for our city.
Mr. Mayor, you're absolutely right. And I have to tell you that our policy actually is being looked at by many as a potential model policy in many places. We go after the bad guys wherever they are. If you look at year-to-date numbers versus 3-year-to-date numbers, we're down about 34% serious crime. Similarly, in traffic accidents, if you're committing crimes in the city, we're going to go very aggressively. And we have arrested a significant number of people that are here without authority, and we do it on a regular basis when they're committing other crimes. As I indicated, about 10% of the arrests that we make in the last year or so have been identified people that are here without authority.
Well, and I think there's some areas where I think we actually go beyond. I think you've indicated to me, for example, with our DUI checkpoints and things like that, where most people don't release that. Most people don't understand that most people who go through those checkpoints never have status because they're never actually arrested.
Right.
Whereas we, if you want to explain, sure. We actually go through the arresting, and we probably do a much more complete job as far as immigration status than others do.
Yeah, a common practice is in this region is to have what is basically a catch and release with DUIs. You arrest them if they if you can ascertain who they are to a level of comfort, they get released, and then you hope that they show up in court. The problem with that is that you sometimes don't get to really know all the things that you need to know about that person. You don't have a full booking process.
Well, and what you just said, if they're here illegally, the odds of them ever showing up for court on a catch and release are slim to none in most cases.
Well, you know, frankly, I would say that it's not just here illegally. I mean, you know, if you look at the level, the number of warrants, the outstanding warrants in the county, most of them are not people that are here illegally. By and large, they're people that were born and raised here. They just decided they're not going to show up. They're rolling the dice. They know that the system is broken, and they know that they are likely to be out there for a long period of time before they get caught. So there's no percentage loss for them in showing up. So what we're doing is we're bringing you in, and regardless of whether you're here legally or not, we're going through an entire process of fingerprinting. And, you know, on the one hand, it slows the process, but on the other hand, we're ensuring that the people that need to stay in jail stay in jail.
And I understand what you're saying. The perception in the public, though, is that there's a huge problem because of illegals. Because we had the unfortunate incident, two or three incidents, where you had someone who's here illegally who was involved in a very serious, fatal DUI-related accident. And so the perception out there is that. And what I guess the point I'm making is that, as I understand your procedures, that's set up to catch everybody who is evading the system. And it goes beyond what other agencies are doing, and therefore brings in the illegals that also are evading the system. And so in many areas, we're going beyond what I think others are doing because we're focusing on the crime aspect and in keeping the city safe. And as part of that, our natural procedures create situations where we're doing the job. So I appreciate that.
You're absolutely right, Mr. Mayor.
Okay. Let's go on to the next thing.
Okay. Next area I would like to give you an update on is our Civilian Investigator Specialist Program, which I'll refer to as our CIS program. This is a pilot program that there is no other model for within the nation. Our objective in this program is to use civilian employees to handle our first responders to property crimes and certain types of property crimes where the suspect is not on scene. They're also cross-trained not only in the first responder, but also the ability to do the forensic work as well. These are typically responsibilities that patrol officers handled in terms of the first response to the crime scene, and as well as use of our crime scene techs that would come out subsequently that to process the scene. So this allows the civilian employees to handle both of those aspects of an investigation and basically be able to handle that crime scene in totality. The objectives of the program is for a quality investigation and with really a focus on exceptional customer service. And we try to accomplish that through several means. Number one is to set up appointments, if possible, with the victim so that we can come out at a time that's convenient for them, that also is fits where there's not any kind of delay, where they can at least set up a time frame and have the response out there. In addition to that, it allows us to spend the time on the scene, process both the initial investigation, which is interviewing victims, witnesses, canvassing the neighborhood. In addition to that, as I said, process the crime scene as well. In our current model, we'll have patrol officers go out for a first response, and then perhaps afterwards, an hour or two later, depending on the call volume, the crime scene tech would come and process that scene. So in terms of better customer service, they're getting all of that at one time. So certainly looking for to measure in three particular areas. We expect to see in our measurements to see the effectiveness of this program, the impact on the customer service and the quality investigations, but also we expect to see an impact to the crime scene technicians that now can respond more quickly to our more violent offenses and more complicated crime scenes as well. And most importantly, we're also looking for the impact of patrol, as was mentioned earlier, the ability to allow the officers to, since they are not on these delayed property crime calls, they're able to do some of the more proactive policing that we're looking for. go to the dots where the problems are, or to do some of the preventative measures that we talked about earlier. And we're looking to see that they would have the ability to do that more concretely. To give you an idea of some of the timelines involved with that, we have 11 civilian investigative specialists that were hired. They began a 10-week training academy back on January 26th. All 11 graduated and started their field training program on April 6th. And that is where they're currently at. Our pilot program is ran at the Superstition substation, which is on the east side of town. They are doing their field training program at this time, and they will go with a solo status on June 1st, 2009, as that program proceeds. Next, I would like to give you an update. Much of this information we did in a prior council presentation, but I want to give you an update of where it's at related to the privatization of municipal security program. As you know, it's a blended program with using our current city employees, our municipal security, and blending that with the use of private security. During our program development of this, we were able to fund these positions with no layoffs. It was used with positions that were vacated through attrition. I located some of the, or give you a listing there, some of the locations that the privatization will be impacting. They will be servicing the library, the museum, the East Mesa Service Center, and the municipal building on North Center. We will continue to have city municipal security officers at the court, the MAC, and the city plaza. Right now, to give you an update on the status, we are finalizing the selection of the vendor and also finalizing the contract. We project at this point that implementation date with private security component should be complete somewhere around June 1st of this year. Okay. Last area I want to update you on, again, did a presentation a short time ago to council on the bond projects, and just want to reacquaint you with each of those projects. First is the range improvements. We are currently still in the design phase. That is a replacement of a classroom building. At this stage, we're using a trailer that was a temporary trailer in place for about 25 years. We are building a two classrooms capabilities in a building there, and that design phase is currently underway. Also, we're doing a security fence improvements at our Center Against Family Violence. That is currently in design as well, with an expected completion later this year. We're also doing a joint project with fire. As you know, we share the training facility operations with fire. Together, we are working on a bond project that is also in design phase for additional capabilities at that site for classrooms, our defensive tactics rooms, and other amenities that allows us to function at that as we service both our academies as well as our in-service personnel. The fourth project listed there is our Dobson Police substation replacement. Or police station replacement. We are still currently in our site acquisition phase of that project. I'm looking at a variety of sites, both some that have structures on, some that are vacant, and really looking at the totality of options that we have in that area to make the best possible decision based on price as well as what's best there in the community as well. That, as I mentioned, that is still in the site acquisition phase at this time. Last project listed is our aviation program. We have purchased a fixed-wing airplane replacement. We currently are out for a request for bid on our camera equipment that is associated with that fixed wing. And we also are anticipate a future purchase replacement of a helicopter as well here during the next coming year. And that is a quick summation of our 2008 bond projects.
And Chief, as we go through the grants, I think we're pretty much familiar with most of these. If there's one or two that you want to highlight that we might not have talked about before.
Mr. Mayor, okay. Quite frankly, I know that you're short of time, and I would prefer to be ready to answer a question you may have.
Move to that. Councilman Richens has some questions.
I just wanted to repeat the same thing that we told Fire about acquiring property. There's a lot of vacant office buildings and big box buildings in the Dobson District. And I know not all of them would be suitable, and I know you've evaluated a huge range of possibilities, but my preference would always be to revitalize rather than build new if we can avoid it. So we get a lot of, of course, it's got to be cost effective, but always look at coupling a revitalization need with a city need. And this will be a great
a great project if we can get it done right.
I'm glad that you raised that issue because that's been raised before. There are several things that you need to consider when you're building a police station. Police stations are 24-hour operation. Generally, when you build shopping centers, and by the way, I'm quoting people in the business. We went through this. You're building buildings that generally are designed to start decaying and having significant issues within 10 years on a use that is not on a 24-hour operation. I have personally been involved in places where we took existing facilities and turned them into police stations, and at the end of the day, they all turned out to be much more expensive. Typical police facility is a 50-year facility that gets used around the clock. Having said that, I fully agree with you that we should go into the areas that need revitalization and perhaps tear down and build or be close to that area. But I think we have to be very careful about going into existing facilities because sometimes the refurbishing and then the future maintenance cost of those facilities for a police operation are huge.
Well, and as you go into, Chief, I think one thing that's different is that if you look at the last two or three projects we've done, they've been, I mean, I live right down the street from the Red Mountain one, for example, and it's almost like a fortress-type environment. And what we're looking for now is the exact opposite of that, where it's very much an open community, which I think lends itself for opportunities to at least place the facility in a
Absolutely.
In an area that we can take advantage of revitalization.
And we would definitely want to be a partner in that, and that's what we're
looking for. Councilmember Kavanaugh.
Thank you, and I do know that your staff has worked very hard looking at all the different alternatives in terms of adaptive reuse of buildings versus new facilities, and I understand the reasons why I would certainly probably lean to a new facility to design it correctly for community access, but also be hardened for your needs as well. It also creates a very good and interesting opportunity to use our Fiesta District guidelines that we've just adopted to show the community how you can do new building in that area and set a tone or set a good standard for private investment to follow. But I know that your staff has worked very hard at looking both at sites, at looking at designs, looking at architects, and in trying to work towards getting that 24-hour building, because it is a different building than we typically see in many of our public places. Thank you.
Thank you, Councilmember. Councilmember Pinter.
Thanks, Chief. Just wanted to offer you a perspective. The Fusion Center, ComStat, Civilian Investigator Program, different service delivery, Six Sigma, drop in crime. These are all things that we can celebrate the accomplishments under some really dire circumstances. Appreciate all the good things that the men and women of the police department are doing. This gets lost in some of the talk that's out there, but there's a tremendous amount of positive accomplishments happening at the police department, and so you have my appreciation, I'm sure the others too, for what's going on. Thanks.
Thank you, Councilman.
Yeah, and I'd like to echo what Councilman Pinter said. Thank you. Across the board, we're proud of our police department. We know, we always know we have challenges, and at the end of the day, you brought up a real challenge. It's all about people. And we know that certainly in the police and in the fire area, we're nothing without the people that are involved. And both departments are dealing with some fairly significant financial challenges. And I think your department's been a model for how to not only react but to adapt to those, to raise the level of service. I hope that as we go forward, we're not having this discussion 4 and 5 years from now, that we can return to a little bit of normalcy, but I'm not so sure that what normalcy will be.
Sure.
And so I appreciate the fact that you're recognizing that we're going to have to change the way that we deliver services. We cannot just go for temporary fixes, that some of these things and the approaches we're taking are going to be permanent, because that will be the world we live in for quite a while. And so we understand your challenges. We get it. We hear it a lot, and we appreciate all that you do.
Thank you very much.
Any other questions? Okay, thank you. We'll now move on to a presentation on our next favorite subject, utility rates.
Yeah, Mayor and Council, I'm going to go ahead and we're going to invite Chuck, and utilities directors can be close by hand, but I'm going to go ahead and go through the presentation so we can go through fairly quickly, because we know we're getting tight on time. I am not going to go through every slide, but I just, you should have the packet in front of you. If you go to slide 2, there we outline really just our operations, our financial summaries. This is kind of the principles that we've been adopted either in written policy by the council or as an operations level about how we look at each of the separate utilities and how they will be managed financially. And the perspective we're looking at goes out right now in the forecast we're looking at is a 2014-15 fiscal year. And that really is important for us as we look at fund balances and rates that we're going to be proposing to you. The rates that are in front of you that are being proposed, they'll be in your rate schedules, have already gone to the Audit and Finance Committee, but we want to bring it to the full council. Now, what you have in this packet is you have each of the four different utilities that are outlined, and for each section, and actually if we can just go to, we're going to skip past the electric utility because it has, you can look at it, but at page 8 it shows that we're not proposing any rate increases over the next few years, but to kind of give an example of what...
That is not a typo. Those zeros are meant to be there.
Those zeros are meant to be there.
I want to make sure.
But if we will go, if you could turn with me possibly to page 9, just go to page 9. What you'll see on page 9, and this is a format we use through all the utilities, that we've outlined for you the capital program for each one of the utilities. So you'll see this repeated for each one. And we've divided out the capital needs. And this includes both the debt service, it includes purchase capital, capital we're paying for as you go, and anticipated capital improvement programs in the future. And we've identified in that capital program over the next 6 years that portion which has been designated today that's related to growth and that which is providing for a replacement of aging infrastructure. You'll notice in gas is going to have probably heavier weighted towards growth than some of the other utilities because
if you could go back to slide 6 to show the difference. There you go. So with electrical, it's almost all
there you go.
Replacement of aging infrastructure.
Yeah. And electric obviously has to do in a very, it's a defined, limited area of service in Mesa. Whereas
you go back to 9.
Gas,
yeah.
Obviously we have an area outside of Mesa that we serve, the Magnolia area, which is growing and continues to experience growth, especially in the commercial area. So you see that difference there. We could go to, for example, to slide 12, and now you see how it works, the water infrastructure. You see the split, where in the earlier years, you see some kind of a combination, but weighted heavier in these first few years, more towards aging infrastructure. And out into the future, we have some opportunities or some projects, some large projects related to growth. Now, all of those will continue to be evaluated. We understand under the current economic conditions, the need to keep up with growth or manage growth with utilities may not be what we anticipate today. That may have to be readjusted and reconsidered. The rates that we're applying for today or requesting today for this budget really consider what's happening in these first few years, but we just want, this is our perspective looking way out into the future. Every year we have to reevaluate, really identify whether the anticipated growth is really keeping up with us. Slide 13 shows you the perspective of what the relationship between the growth and the debt service amount, as well as the fund balance. And you'll notice in some of the utilities where they'll start off in these early years with a fairly large fund balance that was intended to build those fund balances up with anticipation of the growth, as you can see, in debt service. So you can see on page 13, kind of the opposite, you know, you have high fund balances that continue to draw down as the debt service goes up. That allows us to manage those funds well. It also allows us to avoid significant spikes in rates out into the future so we can draw down on our cash reserves at the same time. So that's what dynamic, I think that's a good slide to show that dynamic between as we draw down on the reserves as a result of increasing costs of capital improvements and debt service obligations into the future.
And once again, the debt that we're talking about here are all revenue-based bonds, not general fund, general obligation type bonds. And so the debt that we incur is paid for by the rate players eventually.
Yes.
Those who use the system end up paying for the system, but since there is obviously, once you incur debt, there's a fixed obligation, and you have rates and uses and growth that may or may not meet our projections, which is why we have reserve levels. We plan for those changes and those adjustments, and that's how they even out.
Correct.
Okay.
Slide 14 again shows you rates being proposed for the next year and with the, what the actual dollar amount on an average monthly resident would be for those increases. And then again, we do the same thing for wastewater. You'll see the two different charts with the different types of capital expenditures. Notice in wastewater, tremendous amount of resources are going into the existing infrastructure, replacement and rehab, but it's slide 16 continues again to show you the increasing costs of that of those capital programs through debt service and the impact it has on the fund balance. And again, on slide 17, you see the impact on the rates, but what it translates to an actual dollar amount. Sometimes the rates may seem fairly high, but we really wanted what is the true impact from a dollar perspective. So I'll stop there.
Yeah. Councilmember Richens.
I just had a quick question. I had somebody ask me this the other day, and I didn't know the answer to it. You look at fiscal year 09-10, and we have a fund balance that exceeds our debt service. What would be the net effect going forward, and why would or wouldn't we just pay off the bonds, just pay off all the debt? We have $10 million left over.
Think of the debt. The fund balance is really one-time amount of dollars that's sitting there. The debt service, as you can see, continues to go on for 20 years, and at some points it's actually increasing. So if you used all your fund balance, you wouldn't have, that would, you'd go to zero. It doesn't continue to come back.
I mean, yeah, it would go like, well, if, but give me it's a, not a 27 minus 17 equals 10.
No, because if I may.
I just don't know the answer.
It's the comparison of your mortgage on your house. You owe X number of dollars, but the debt service is your monthly payment.
Well, but I guess the question, if I'm understanding Councilman Richens, is if I have a, taking your example, a $200,000 mortgage on my house, and I happen to have $40,000, and let's say I won the lottery, I have a choice. I can either leave that $40,000 in the bank to protect against my future mortgage payments, my monthly payments, or else I can take that $40,000 and pay down my $200,000 mortgage and make it a $160,000 mortgage.
Well, in this,
is that accurate?
Yeah, that's kind of what I'm asking. Well, so is this like, you have a line that says debt service. Well, what's the total debt?
Well, the total debt, I mean, for example, the debt goes out for 20 years. So in the utilities, our outstanding debt could be, just in this program, where was that slide, Chuck, at the beginning?
It's we slide showed five,
there's $500 million worth of capital programs for all the utilities just in these 6 years. There's probably, I don't know, less than $100 million in fund balance for all of the utilities that's available for that same period of time.
Okay, so the mortgage is $500 million?
Yep. For the next 6 years. It continues out beyond that. That's just, we're still missing the point.
We could take the fund balance and pay down debt. Now, remember, though, one thing is that we don't know 2 and 3 and 4 years from now what the economy is going to be like, what our rate collection is going to be like, and what I think we're saying is that we keep those reserves in part to guard against future rate fluctuations. Because if you took the money, if you took that extra $20 million, $40 million, and just paid down existing debt, you still have a base debt obligation on the remaining debt.
Right.
What we may not have is we may not have the rate structure, because if the growth doesn't match it, or let's say we have a spike in foreclosures where our rates are leveled off, we've anticipated paying those debt payments out of the combination of the rates and the reserve. If that reserve's gone, the only place you have now to make those monthly payments 3 years from now is in raising rates.
You may be forced to do rate changes in the middle of the year.
Yeah, huge. And I don't think people fully understood that's not the total debt in the system. That
no,
a much
it's
greater
not.
It number.
Is. And frankly,
there somewhere, because by spreading it out, it doesn't
we're
ever.
Trying to mitigate against, as the mayor said, contingencies. Let me give you a great example. The fact that the city set up a fairly healthy fund balance in the general fund this last year was significant in absorbing the cash flow changes, you know, fall off in July.
Yeah.
We absorbed for the first 6 months of the year a tremendous amount in the fund because we had a fund balance. We could absorb those losses, or not losses, but not receiving the sales tax we anticipated. If we hadn't had those fund balances, we would have to go to other sources to find those cash reserves. So those fund balances are significant. They're kind of like our absorption on difficult times. Whether it's revenues, shortfall revenues coming in, or unexpected, you know, expenditure, emergency expenditures, that allows us, it gives us that cushion to manage that. And in this case, we're also using it to manage against increasing, as we saw going on into the future, these significant increases in our debt service, and as they were going up, instead of trying to put all that into the rate increases, we're absorbing some of that through reducing our cash reserves and doing that and rates, but not nearly the same amount.
Well, when you say you absorb it, actually you plan for it,
right?
And you could you say you base your rate on the amount of the reserves you want to create, and that may mean that your reserves go up, but then they go down. In essence, you're leveling off for our ratepayers, so we don't have
these
rate spikes.
We're trying to manage that. Yeah.
And I didn't have the information to articulate a total. They're like, well, what's the total debt on the system then?
We can get you that number.
That'd be a helpful number. That when we do these presentations, we look at our debt service number. Well, show us what's the if we were to look at our mortgage, what sure. we owe on our mortgage. And that's a great way to break down. I appreciate
Councilman,
that.
Even slide 5 gives you just for the 6-year period the total forecasted capital needs for just the next six years.
Right. Yeah, I saw that. You know, when we talk in terms of capital needs and stuff, it's hard to translate that into the public.
Vice Mayor has a question or comment.
Well, and this was a perfect example of why we have the cash reserves and why our rating agencies look at it, because we were able to weather a real fast change in our revenues coming in.
Yeah, and remember, this is, and I don't want people to think that we've built up this huge rainy day fund, because it's really not a rainy day fund. It's a protection against economic fluctuations, because we do have fixed obligations going out many, many years. And so we set up these reserves to make sure that those fixed debt obligations are not compromised through fluctuations in the economy, which is what we had to do. I mean, we had fixed obligations. Our revenue took a deep dive, but luckily we had established reserves that helped us to even those out and pull through those. Okay. Councilmember Kavanaugh.
And just a question. Your goal is to maintain 8 to 10% fund balance, and obviously in some of the areas we have some healthy fund balances right now. And again, I've raised this question before. This could be a source, if the council would so consider, to perhaps increase the transfer to the general fund from the electric utility, for example, if we were looking for a source to help boost the human services funds that we talked about earlier. But if you took a relatively small amount, as I see it, you'd still have a fund balance well within your target range for a zone of comfort. Am I correct?
Correct.
Right. Thank you.
Okay. And once again, another thing that I get a lot of questions on is whether we actually bleed money out of the profits of our utilities to cover normal operating expense. And there is an amount, yes, that net, what do you want to call it, profit, net income, whatever, that we utilize. However, our rates are set through a policy the previous council set, which I agree with wholeheartedly, that we would not rely on the ratepayers to cover gaps, continuing gaps, and as a policy, continuing gaps. And it's a little different than what I think Councilman Kavanaugh was talking about. We would not use these transfers to cover every ongoing fluctuations in general fund expenditures. So what the previous council did was, and city management agreed, to fix the amount that is utilized, or the amount of profits that are taken from our utilities to cover general fund obligations, to fix that amount, so that we don't get into the big argument that we're going to raise rates simply to cover deficits. That is not what's going on. Is that an accurate description, Mr. Brady? Mm-hmm. Want to make sure we're clear on that. The amount of we call it fund transfer. I know people don't really understand that, but the amount of net profits, net income off the utilities that is going into general fund has been fixed. So we get away from budgeting by rate increase. That is not the intent.
Through the forecast period for each one of these utilities, the amount that of the profit that is being received to the city is fairly level throughout the period.
The fixed transfer applies then to each of the individual.
Right.
I get it. Okay. All right. Any other questions? Thank you very much. Appreciate it. And by the way, these rates will go through, like you said, the normal process through the Audit and Finance Committee, and will come before us
on May. May 4th?
It's in the thing sometime in May.
May 4th.
Next item is throughout the year, we have citizens who are unable to continue with their service on our boards and commissions, and so I am presenting to you a recommendation for certain individuals to fill vacancies that have been created during the year. Now, this is not terms that have expired. That will come up in June, where we will present to you another list, but this is simply to cover those vacancies that have occurred because of resignation from the board. We have a motion to approve, Councilman Kavanaugh, second by Councilman Summers. Any discussion? All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Motion carries. Thank you very much to all who are willing to serve, and once again, to anyone who's listening, we have a great need for citizens to serve on our boards and commissions. Please contact your council member in your district, or my assistant, Nikki Amberg, if you are interested. We always have a need for willing hands, and appreciate that. The only thing on here, reports very quickly, I want to bring up one thing, and Vice Mayor, you want to cover this since you are deeply involved with our sister cities?
Yesterday we received notification that Mesa Sister Cities has been selected to receive the Innovation Sustainable Development Award for a city of population 100,000 to 500,000. We'll be recognized during the annual award ceremony in this year's annual Sister Cities Conference in Ireland. So we're being awarded this for our medical mission to Caraz, Peru, that Dr. Raul Osorio heads up, that we do regularly, and it's going to be great recognition for our sister cities and a lot of hard work.
Congratulations to them. Councilmember Higgins.
This Sunday, Monday, and Tuesday, Councilmember Richens and I attended the Arizona Town Hall on transportation, and it was very enlightening.
We're glad you were enlightened.
It was a great discussion with statewide leaders on meeting the needs of our transportation for the next century, pretty much. It's very good.
Okay. And congratulations to the Convention and Visitors Bureau. Had a nice event last night celebrating their 25th year. I think Downtown Mesa Association is coming on 25 years. Gateway Airport, we had many in the council and city staff attended the Gateway Airport 15th year anniversary on Monday. So we have a lot of anniversaries and great accomplishments coming up. Anything else to report? Mr. Brady, meetings.
Yes, just a reminder, council, that there is a Falcon Field open house this Saturday from 8 a.m. to 4 p.m. And so we invite you all out to that. It's going to be, I think, quite an impressive showcase of different modes of transportation. And also want to remind you that the next study session will be Thursday, April 30th, and our next council meeting will be May 4th. And just one announcement, we received some recognition for our fleet management group, specifically the Fleet West Repair Facility. They received the Automotive Service Excellence Blue Seal of Excellence Award, which is pretty difficult to get in the area of automotive services. So we want to congratulate them for creating a high standard and accomplishing that. Thank you very much.
And we forgot one item. Yesterday, Councilmember Summers, you want to report on the recycle bank?
Oh, yeah.
I forgot about that. We had, the mayor and I had an opportunity to go to Kerr Elementary School. They won the competition for, was it a video they did?
The DVD.
I think a DVD that they did on recycling and learning the three R's, reduce, reuse, and recycle. And we had the fourth reward. They got little backpacks made out of recycled material that the mayor conjured with mayor's magic.
Mayor's magic.
And they were quite excited about that. So we're moving that program forward. And since you made me talk, as a point of personal privilege, I was... last night I wasn't able to attend the opening event up in Northeast because my daughter and my son as well were awarded Golden Scholars for Gilbert Public Schools. They both have GPAs. My son is 4.4, my daughter's 4.5. So congratulations to them.
I couldn't count above three. So
neither could I. They're smarter than their father.
And that recycle bank, City of Mesa is the first city in the state to establish a recycle bank program. So congratulations to our solid waste and recycling staff for that.
Will we be running that DVD on Channel 11?
We should. It's a good idea. see what it is. Okay. All right. Ms. Crocker, do we have any requests to speak from citizens?
No requests, Mayor.
All right. There being none, I will entertain a motion to move into executive session. Have a motion. Second. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
We are now moving into executive session. Thank you very much.